It's time for Windows Weekly. Paul Thurrott's here. Richard Campbell's here. And so is the quarterly results for Microsoft. The yearly results are in, too. You won't believe how much money Microsoft made. How much does AI cost? Is it a profit center? And what is Microsoft's new billion-dollar business? All that and more coming up next on Windows Weekly. This show is brought to you by Cisco Meraki. Without a cloud-managed network, businesses inevitably fall behind. Experience the ease and efficiency of Meraki's single platform to elevate the place where your employees and customers come together. Cisco Meraki maximizes uptime and minimizes loss to digitally transform your organization. Meraki's intuitive interface, increased connectivity, and multi-site management keep your organization operating seamlessly and securely wherever you're team is. Let Cisco Meraki's 24/7 available support help your organization's remote, on-site, and hybrid teams always do their best work. Visit meraki.cisco.com/twit.
Podcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Windows Weekly with Paul Thurrott and Richard Campbell, episode 839, recorded Wednesday, July 26th, 2023. Velcro and Tang. This episode of Windows Weekly is brought to you by ACI Learning. Keep your team's IT skills current. Visit go.acilearning.com/twit. Twit listeners will receive at least 20% off or as much as 65% off an IT Pro Enterprise solution plan. That's based on the size of your team. And when you fill out their form, you will get a proper quote tailored to your needs. It's time for Windows Weekly, the show where we cover the latest news from Microsoft. And yes, this is an earnings week. So earnings learnings for today. On your left, Mr. Paul Thurrott from Thurrott.com. He's also in Mexico City, Mexico. On your right, Richard Campbell, also North America, but this time Coquitlam, British Columbia, host of Runez Radio and .NET Rocks. Hello, you two.
Hello, hello.
Hello. Did you get up at 4 a.m. to watch Samsung Unrested?
I did not. Couldn't care less.
Nor did I. But I did order the flip phone because I, not the folding phone, but the flipping phone. Because I'm a sheeple, and I saw the ad, and now I have to have it. No, I just want to try it out. I think it looks pretty sweet. Okay, enough of that. No more of that. Yep. Let's go right to the earnings learnings. Was it a good quarter?
It was I'm all choked up.
Such a good quarter. How good was it?
Yeah. I'll tell you how good it was. I spent 3 hours this morning feverishly writing an analysis of the earnings and with the hope of figuring out where they're paying for AI. And I have to say, I don't do this a lot with Microsoft, but I got the answer.
Oh, wow.
So it was kind of fun. But just to the earnings, let's see.
What's the top line? They made money, right?
Giant pile of money.
Net income of $20.1 billion in the quarter on revenues.
That's
of
$56.2 billion. 20 yep. billion. Okay.
56.2 billion. So also the end of their fiscal year. So for the fiscal year, net income of $72.4 billion and revenues of $212 billion.
That's pretty good.
Double-digit yearly gains, income.
So this is not their biggest quarter. This is a smaller quarter.
Yeah, this was a small one. I mean,
they're making more than a billion a week. Profit.
Yeah, they're doing okay. They announced a new billion-dollar business, which we'll get to. Intelligent Cloud, biggest business, right? This is Azure, right? $24 billion in revenues. Not the first time it's been over $20 billion. Up 15% year over year. That thing's
going
gangbusters.
How does that compare to AWS?
Well, it doesn't. So Microsoft invents something called the Microsoft Cloud that they use to compare to AWS, and I refuse to discuss it because it's made up. So,
well,
I don't even know the number. Yeah. Screw them. Well, the reason is they cherry pick parts of their business that could be in, often are in other parts of the business, the other business units, and I just, whatever.
Do they do that to make their numbers look more favorable?
Yeah, of course.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, I was telling Richard before the show.
That wouldn't be nice.
Richard is still settling into my quarterly mania over earnings. You might want to, this medicine that will help.
It's going to take a few more quarters.
Yeah, you'll get used to it. But one of the things that's happened over the years is, and probably not just with Microsoft, but I'm kind of laser focused on Microsoft, obviously. So Microsoft has gotten vaguer and vaguer and vaguer when it comes to reporting the financial results of individual businesses or products and things. They talk in terms of, you know, this thing revenue growth was X percent, where you never know what it began at. So there's no way to know what it is, you know, that kind of stuff. So there's tons and tons of that. We're going to go through a lot of it, but anyway, Azure is the biggest part, or Intelligent Cloud, which is mostly Azure. Productivity and business processes. This is Microsoft 365, you know, LinkedIn, Dynamics, et cetera. It's basically Office, Microsoft, and Microsoft 365. 18.3 billion in revenues, gained a 10% year over year. So those two businesses both grew double digits, which they've been doing, and they are both on this kind of upward trajectory. There was a time back when the business units were all making about $11 billion a piece, where they were kind of roughly even. Mm-hmm. So those two have gone from 11 to 24 and 18 billion respectively. More personal computing, which is the third and the smallest of these, has gone from 11 to about 13, depending on the quarter. It kind of goes up and down. This particular quarter, there were 13.9 billion in revenues, a decline of 4% year over year. And it's for all the obvious reasons. Windows revenues down, PC market stinks. We're going to get to that. Surface tanked hard 20% year over year.
Like every other PC maker.
Yeah, maybe worse than every other, but yes, in the ballpark for sure. Mm-hmm. And then gaming was basically flat. So familiar kind of trend there, where Xbox hardware, meaning consoles mostly, but also peripherals, down big, and software and services up to a minor degree. It basically works out to be flat. So that's the mile high view on Microsoft. I don't dive into all of it, but every quarter I write kind of an analysis about the parts of the business I care about most. I actually skipped over Microsoft 365 this time by mistake, but it still ended up being one of my longest articles on this topic. But I think we can condense. So Windows and Surface are both impacted by the broader trends in the PC market, right? No surprise there. Windows revenues from PC makers fell 12% year over year. Let me see if I can find the numbers. Yep. So subsequent or the previous sequential quarters, 15, 39, and 28% drops. So in that sense, hopefully we've crested that hill. But the way Microsoft's talking is they don't actually expect to see any relief anytime soon. And this coming quarter is going to also have a double-digit revenue drop from PC makers. So not good there. The commercial stuff is okay for Windows. Nothing, you know, much to say. In fact, in addition to being vague about reporting on different businesses, the other way they can be vague is by not mentioning them. So they've done that all over the place in this report. So with regards to PC sales, for example, they're not separating out consumer and business sales. They're not separating out Windows revenues from commercial licenses, which is businesses. We can guess as to the reasons why. I think it has to do with the fact that Windows 11 still is not seeing strong uptick with businesses.
On the enterprise side, for sure.
Yeah, that's my guess.
I got a couple of things that I find interesting. One is, why did they break out enterprise mobility, whatever that is, from intelligent cloud? Because near as I can tell, enterprise mobility is Azure Active Directory.
Well, yeah. So the biggest chunk of that is probably what used to be, or maybe it's still called Intune.
Right.
And when you talk about seats, this is the number of businesses that are using what we'll call like a light touch cloud-based management infrastructure as opposed to full-blown, right? You know, this would be better than anybody, but I mean, just so people listening. That's an interesting one because, well, for two reasons. You called it out. Why is it part of Intelligent Cloud? Interesting. Mm-hmm. I guess because it's a cloud service, right?
Well, and so why is it broken out separately? Like, it's just bizarre that you would
talk about. I don't know why, but I'll take it to another level and say, why do they actually give us the seats? They actually, this is the rare area where we know an actual hard number, which is the literal number of users.
Except we don't know what that number is. We don't know why it's important, and we don't know why you told us.
I know. Because Windows, which is part of more personal computing, has commercial PC or commercial licenses associated with it, you would assume that this would be maybe in Microsoft 365, maybe being, I don't know.
Well, there's the thing is you can't use cloud or 365 without it.
Actually, I'm talking through this. Let me guess. Here's my guess. this type of management infrastructure used to be provided by on-prem servers, right? Windows Server. Mm-hmm. And then whatever servers you would run on top. What was it called? They still have it. What's the heavy system management or whatever the hell it's called?
System Center.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. So Intune and System Center followed kind of diverging and converging paths depending on the year. Yeah. But okay. Those revenues are part of Intelligent Cloud because it also includes server, which today is kind of a legacy business. So it's kind of cloud and legacy. So I guess this is because the cloud part of it Intune is cloud and AAD or whatever we're calling it this week is cloud. I mean, that might be, I think that's why. I guess
I'm not going to say Entra. Oh, damn.
Microsoft Cloud's not coming out of my mouth and whatever you just said. And then I'll, do this every time you say
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
All right. one fun bit of news for Windows, sort of. The combined revenues from Azure Virtual Desktop and Windows 365, which obviously shares a common infrastructure. This
is right. Remote both desktop. Products, we're still trying to figure out why they're making them, right?
here's why. This fiscal year, for the first time, crossed $1 billion in revenues.
So this is the new billion-dollar business.
That's right.
They're finally getting...
Which is nice because it's replacing Surface, which I believe is very much no longer a billion-dollar business. In fact, it's probably way south of that.
Well, let's talk about the Surface side, because why are their hardware sales down? I guess everybody else took the hardware numbers a quarter earlier. Why are theirs later?
Here we have to speculate. So this is, of all the stuff I looked at in Microsoft's earnings announcements, I go through all of it, but I'm looking for specific things, right?
Right.
There was one item on this particular report where it was literally the sound of record scratch, car screeching to a halt before it hit something, and it was Surface.
Right.
And in their actual publicly available report, first of all, they don't use the term Surface even once. The term Surface did not come up even once in the post-earnings conference call. They've started calling it devices. Mm. And the reason is I don't know if this is the reason is, but they pulled HoloLens into this thing. So now it's Surface plus HoloLens.
Right.
For the most part, HoloLens does not contribute meaningfully in any way with revenues.
No, it's a niche experimental product.
So, yeah. So I think when we look at devices, we can kind of say this is a Surface, right? I mean, and we have historical trends to look at. We can kind of prove that might be true or whatever. Devices is Surfaces. I refuse to call this thing devices. That's another one of my little mental pet peeves. Anyway, there was one sentence. Actually, I will use the term. Devices revenues declined 20%. That's all it said. There was no context. There was no nothing.
What market spaces? What devices? Yeah.
There was a chart that showed, and it's funny. Here again, they cherry pick. They don't show everything, but one of the things they showed, for example, they don't show console sale growth or loss quarter to quarter, even though they talk about it. But they did show Surface over four quarters. So interestingly, if you go back over the four prior consecutive quarters, sequential quarters, Surface revenue gains were actually 12% and 2% a year ago. But then they declined by 39% and 30% in the previous two quarters, respectively. So 20% may look good, but when you're looking for the answer why, right? Uh-huh. So,
and I would assume it's primary consumer, actually.
Yeah. Right.
Also, there's been no new hardware.
Yeah. I think it's a mix of issues. So the one thing in the conference call, they did say a few things. This, first of all, the results were in line with what they expected, which is okay. So you expect
telegraphed.
They expect another revenue decline. This one's going to go back up into the 30%
on hardware. 30s.
Yep. On devices in this quarter, which I don't mean to say makes sense, but it is the quarter before
the new hardware.
Yeah. Yes. In some ways it's following the PC market. The Surface sales fell harder than the PC market overall, though. They fell harder than the Windows number, which actually mapped pretty closely to what IDC said, right? Somewhere between 10% and 12% or 13% decline, right?
Yeah, and that would have been the trailing indicator because the PC makers announced slowing in sales. Of course, Windows is going to take a hit.
So I'll ask you a question because this is what they said. Tell me what you think this means. Microsoft, where did it say? Let me just find the exact quote here. I can't find it. Anyway, what Microsoft said was, Microsoft is refocusing Surface to focus on higher margin products. What could that be?
HoloLens? I don't think that high.
No, this was there's no margin if you don't sell any. You have to sell them first. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Surface is something, it did not start as a premium PC brand. It didn't.
Right.
But starting with Surface Pro 3, I would argue that's the shift. With Surface Pro 4 and Surface Book, they were very clear about it. That was the, we're bringing
these flagships.
Yep. We're going premium. This is when they really started to take on Apple in the PC space, if that makes sense.
I would argue that they did that to convince regular PC makers, you need to build high quality gear and we'll give you some room underneath us by being expensive.
Yeah, but then they did what they did with Lumia once they bought Nokia, which is they really just put out a bunch of low end crap.
Yeah.
So they I'm not going to go through each of the products, but it's the Surface Go stuff, the Surface Laptop Go, all that stuff. It's like this. I feel it tarnishes the brand.
Yeah, I thought they were playing with form factors, and they promptly disappeared too. People didn't buy them.
Right. So the two sides of Surface are they believe that they're innovators in form factor space. They're not. They've had one successful form factor.
Yeah.
And the other side is what it actually ties to that, which is they're basically putting on the copy machine and making different versions of the same thing. So they get, you know, Pro and Go and, you know, it's like whatever.
Yeah.
So to me, they didn't say this, but I feel like Surface is going to get scaled back. There'll be fewer models. You'll see fewer updates.
Well, I would argue they've been successful because the PC market as a whole has innovated on their gear. Like, not that anybody wants a detachable keyboard, but your touch laptops have happened.
That kind of successful doesn't buy you a Ferrari. You know, it just gives you a good reputation. Like if Surface exists to sort of like maybe the NUC did to be a reference design for PC makers to follow. I mean, I guess that's a business of some kind, but.
And I wouldn't mind them. I wouldn't be surprised if they continue to just start making a small marquee line.
Yeah.
Two or three devices that represent, you know, substantial form, maybe one studio style device, like one weirdo form factor.
I think it makes sense. They obviously were hoping Surface would be a volume PC player. They're not. They've never been anything, but
this is schizophrenic. Like, you're either, and I'm misusing the term schizophrenic, so I apologize right off the bat, right? Like, this, we'll call it bipolar.
Two-faced.
Like, on one hand, it's like we're making marquee devices that by nature is boutique and you don't sell a ton of them. Oh, no, we're trying to be main market. Are you really competing with the PC makers or not? Like, how there's a way to live in an ecosystem. Stop messing it up.
There's this myth that people, let me not get into that, but the reality is the PC market today, we see great form factor experimentation occurring, especially with Lenovo. Right.
Yeah.
It's done an incredible dual screen device, all kinds of crazy.
And again, way screen. Too many. Like, I can't keep them.
It's a little much. Them. Yeah. And they change year to year, but God bless them. They're trying. And I think that's interesting. So they're sort of satisfying that role. And we're also seeing tremendous premium PCs, especially from the market leaders, right?
Yeah.
Lenovo, HP, and Dell. You can point to numerous models from all these companies. Fantastic. I'm not sure what the role is Microsoft has to play in this world anymore. So
I think you got to keep the line functioning well enough to at least be a hammer. It's like, if you slack off, we'll build a marquee machine and embarrass you all.
Yeah. So the word Surface, like I said, did not appear in any of their public disclosures, including that.
You get a hint that they're going to phrase that term out.
I find that to be a little weird. You know, the word AI was said 78 times, you know, or something, you know, whatever. Okay. And then Xbox and gaming being the final piece of the more personal computing pie. Obviously, they can't talk too much about, Microsoft and Activision Blizzard. Although I probably have this later in the show actually, but yeah. So I looked at if Microsoft had owned Activision Blizzard over the previous 12 months, what would Microsoft's financials look like?
Right.
And we'll look at that later, I guess. But the quick answer is not too different, actually. You know, like I said last week, I think some guy said, "Hey, do you think they're going to call the combined company Microsoft Activision?" I'm like, no. No, I don't. Activision's revenues in a quarter in the single digit billions, Microsoft's are in the double, they're not even comparable. So within the context of more personal computing, you're looking at the difference between 13-ish billion and 2-ish billion.
Right. It's not the same league.
No, we're not changing the name.
This is not a merger. This is an acquisition.
You call it. So gaming, you know, not great. The two major sides of gaming are, of course, Xbox hardware and Xbox content and services, right? Mm-hmm. So hardware is consoles, software and services is games and subscriptions, right? I think here we see the past and the future of this business, right?
Sure. Hardware hasn't innovated. It is where it is. The X is the unit.
And it's not selling well, you know?
Well, and I would argue there isn't a next generation waiting to be built because we can barely utilize the hardware as it stands.
What are we going to do? Like, we're going to have 8K that isn't really 8K. We already have 4K that's not really 4K. What's the difference?
Exactly.
And a 2x4 is not 2 inches by 4 inches. Gosh darn it.
Inflammable means flammable?
What? Irregardless, I think
yes,
they should be
not
honest.
A word. but it speaks to, you know, I talk to folks in the gaming industry that I know well. It's like, it's just too expensive to build a game that can fully utilize a PS5 or an X. It's 300 people for 18 right. months. If it is the multi-billion dollar game,
it's a Hollywood movie.
I felt guilty because I bought our son a 120 hertz display for his PS5. And I felt bad because he wanted a 240 hertz display.
Oh my God. I was like, what are you? Okay. I was wondering where that was going.
And well, and I said, you can't
are you
have
on welfare, Leo?
4K and yeah, I know. I'm a bad dad. It's just a bad father. That's all there is.
Just eating gruel.
That's funny. Microsoft didn't, I could go back and find this, I think, but they didn't talk about console revenues over a 1 year period. They did talk about the content and services stuff, you know, games and subscriptions over the previous year. So the three previous quarters, this part of the business experienced losses of revenue of 6%, 3% and 12% respectively. So 3% growth last quarter. And then I think 5% this quarter, this thing's trending up finally. So I guess that's good.
I'm appreciating that. We've talked about this a lot, like the Game Pass model, like what they're doing there and what a lot of these acquisitions of gaming are really about, building out the Netflix of gaming is working. People are buying it.
Okay. Yes. But here's the asterisk. And this ties into the vagueness thing I was talking about earlier. Let me step down. We have a business unit called More Personal Computing. Mm-hmm. This business unit, like I said, encompasses Windows, Surface, and Xbox. We don't know what percentage of each of those make up that $13.9 billion, right? We can guess, and we are probably correct, that Windows is most of it, probably over 50% of it, but we don't really know. Xbox is probably most of the rest, and Surface is the small size. That's a guess, but can we put numbers to that? No. So we have this vague box that is some percentage of More Personal Computing. And that part of the business actually has three parts, but the two big parts are Xbox hardware and Xbox software services, right? The third part is just called gaming, and it's things that are not Xbox. I don't know, whatever. But let's just say it's those two. Yeah, so we know that hardware sales are going down by revenue percentages each quarter. We don't, And we know that Xbox software services is now growing, but we also don't know what percentage of that chunk each one is. So if software and services is this tiny slice on the bottom and it's growing, it's not even growing big, but pretend it's growing big because it's small, that doesn't really matter. And if Xbox revenue, hardware revenues are big, but not doing great, mm-hmm. It still might be more valuable right now to the company, right? Because it earns more. We don't know. This is the problem with not knowing.
They haven't disclosed any of this. They don't need to.
Yeah.
You know, the SEC's happy with what they've reported and, you know, close enough.
Yeah. But that's a great example of what I was talking about. Like we can't make intelligent commentary on the relative health of these parts of the business because we don't know.
Really not given the information to do so.
Yeah.
And jump to the end of this or anything.
Well, let me just wrap this up real quick. So just looking ahead, because this is the other important part of all these businesses. Okay, they did bad. How are they going to do in the future? Bad. So overall, single-digit growth in gaming, Xbox content and services, mid to high single digits. That's pretty good. Driven by first-party and third-party content, a lot of good games coming out in the holiday season sort of starts in this quarter. And Xbox Game Pass growth, right, which is great. Mm-hmm. By the way, absolutely no guidance at all on console sales. They hid the historical data on that, although, again, like I said, I could probably go find some of it.
It's out there.
But the fact, this is a little bit like Surface, didn't talk about it. It's like, oh, boy, that's a little weird. But again, I think the future of this business is the part that's growing and the past is the part that's falling. Yeah. And it's not going to happen tomorrow, but I think we're looking at it's Activision Blizzard, which is going to bump up that part of the business.
Sure. Okay, one would speculate what's the only thing that's going to really revise the game business meaningfully is a significant change in tooling. If these machine learning models for building resources get good enough that the major game brands start using them, you know, I'm talking to software developers, not necessarily in gaming, in other areas that are really getting involved with large language models and these kinds of tools. And they're talking about 10% and 20% performance improvements. Like,
you know,
We've been using them long enough now that we're seeing multiple sprints go by and they're consistently outperforming past development efforts.
So one of the phrases I found myself repeating as I thought and wrote about this stuff was this notion of something raising all ships, right? This notion mm-hmm. that AI, you know, whatever. And as you said that, you gave me another example of it, which is, you know, you're talking about major publishers using this, but what happens when the democratization of this happens, yeah. which it is happening, as Microsoft moves Copilot, GitHub Copilot, which we'll talk about in a bit, to what they think of as GitHub Copilot X, right? Which is a series of kind of three big advances.
Yeah.
Can individual developers pay whatever it is, $20 a month, and as game developers, and maybe start creating games that are more sophisticated, more easily, mm-hmm. and not need to take on all that investment and
staff,
team size, and yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Maybe you mentioned Hollywood, which is all on strike right now, and I think part of it is that we are seeing the democratization of that kind of movie making because of this technology as well. That the armies of people that used to
make CGI. Movies on iPhones,
yeah, right?
Or the CGI that in the 1970s and 80s required a Lucasfilm or ILM or whatever. And then by the early 2000s, you had things like the new Battlestar Galactica show, which was just completely off-the-shelf computer-generated graphics, which looked great, you know, for the time. And now we can make those ourselves.
Yeah.
Using off the literally like App Store apps, you know. That stuff is amazing. So
yeah, keeps going further. Yep. But you know the overarching theme here is AI. They made this pivot to AI because they needed something new to create buzz, and it worked.
Yep. This is the thing. Like I said, I went into this, like I'm going to cover those topics. I just blew through in an excited fashion. That's my thing. But this year has been all about AI. Microsoft announced the Bing chat stuff in February.
Yep.
Since then it's announced the Copilot stuff. So now we have this range, and also GitHub, which already exists. So GitHub Copilot probably from a year ago, maybe even two, I don't remember, but whenever that started, we now have that kind of AI permeating all of Microsoft thing happening, right? It's not all there, but it's happening everywhere.
No, it seems apparent that Satya Nadella did a Bill Gates type letter inside the company that said, thou shalt build co-pilots. And every team has had to respond.
So maybe you don't know this. That's exactly what happened. And there were a lot, this happened late last year. I don't know that we've gotten a copy of the full, you know, letter like we used to.
No, like we did with internet tidal wave and trustworthy computing.
But this is when a lot of the pushback started against AI internally, because there were groups, I think, that either didn't want to or didn't feel they could do what he was asking. And of course, there was that ethics thing where I believe leaks at Microsoft led to stories about how Microsoft just disbanded their AI ethics team right in the middle of expanding AI. And that's not exactly what happened.
Not even close to true.
Exactly.
The opposite of what was true.
Yeah. So, yes. So anyway, to your point, yes, that did happen. But here's the thing. So the February quarter is obviously the first calendar quarter of the year. So we get January, February, March. This quarter, which is Microsoft's fiscal fourth quarter, is our calendar second quarter. Mm-hmm. That stuff is all that now it's happening. So there are costs associated with AI, right? This is one of the things we talk about. Mm-hmm. AI transactions or whatever you want to call them are roughly 10 times that of a standard search query. Where's the money coming from, right? So the first thing I did was I looked at their press release and I looked at their ancillary materials and all that. And the phrase AI came up twice in one quote from Satya Nadella. He said it in two sentences in a row. So his stuff was like forward leaning, like we think the power of AI, blah, 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 future, blah, blah, who cares? So I knew what I would have to do is look forward to this conference call with analysts and press. And I knew, and I was right, every single question would be about AI. Every single question. And there were lots of questions, lots more than usual, by the way. Mm. Usually they kind of cut it off at some point. I felt like they went longer just based on the transcript and just the sheer number of questions all about AI.
It just
AI.
Means you're asking the questions they want to answer that they kept going.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, they were prepared for it, that's for sure. So I wrote probably thousands of words on this topic. And rather than spend the next 30 minutes talking through all of that, I'll just succinctly summarize by saying the beauty of Microsoft is that, yes, AI is expensive, but they can afford it.
Right.
And they're already realizing revenues from it.
Yeah.
There are AI-based services up in Azure that are generating revenues right now.
Right.
There are minor revenues coming from the developer end, right? GitHub, Copilot. But
There's a lot of people who signed up for GitHub Copilot. So, I mean,
I can make revenues by selling bananas in the street. It's not about revenues, but profit. I mean, right?
No, Leah, we don't talk about
Yeah, we're not a profit. We're definitely not a profit yet.
Uber's made revenue since the day it started, but it hasn't made a penny.
Well, like Spotify, same thing, right? So, yeah. Well, how do they make money? Volume. So,
isn't it? This is an expensive product, right?
Yeah.
So but here's the thing. So actually, this will be profitable, and I'm not saying it is literally profitable, but the way that it works now is Microsoft has enough operating capital to actually just afford these investments. It is that kind of virtuous cycle where their investments lead to new products, which leads to new revenues, which will lead to profits. They don't say that now. I mean, they just started it. They may not say it ever, but honestly, I think AI is so important that they will. They kept Amy Hood, which is the CEO for Microsoft, and Satya Nadella, the CEO, referenced again and again and again the importance of AI to Azure, which was its growth model for that unbelievable spurt where their stock price went through the roof. They're the second richest company in the world by market cap. All of the growth of Azure speculation, essentially, it's coming back. We're going to have a Terminator 2.
This is a product that requires cloud. And that's was always the issue.
Yeah. Guess what we have? We have cloud.
You built it big enough to build a supercomputer capable of running a workload that almost can't run anywhere else.
Yeah.
So, congratulations. It's a heck of a play.
Microsoft, right. They have the infrastructure. They have the capital. They have the incentive. They have the capability to build all this stuff out. They're one of 2 to 3 companies in the world that can do what they're doing.
Yeah. I would debate whether the other two can.
100%. Yes. This is a bet. Microsoft has a history of saying bet the company. This is bet the company.
Yeah, totally. The question is, and when it comes down to it, I'm pulling up my old startup jobs. It's like, so how long's the runway?
Right. So actually, they're already talking about short-term realization of benefit, right?
Right.
Looking over the next year, they talk about, how much is this going to cost? They actually provide some kind of hard numbers, their capital expenditures, right? This is the money you spend to invest in, physical things, was $10.7 billion in the quarter. $8.9 billion of that Microsoft paid in cash to support cloud demand, which includes its investments in AI infrastructure. Cash.
Right.
They're paying for it with cash.
Well, because they can. And because they can. Financing's now expensive.
Right. Microsoft generated almost $29 billion in cash in the quarter, and free cash flow was $20 billion. So,
right. The fact that you took a little less than half of that and just paid for it.
You're investing in your own future. Smart. Yeah. Anyway,
it's interesting because this is exactly the same situation as with search, for instance. Search is expensive. Nobody thinks about it. You think they'll be able to turn
it's
around?
It's expensive. Well, you know what? It's like that's like saying, you're right. I'm not disagreeing. But Apple would make the argument. Running an app store is expensive. Yeah, but you earn hundreds of billions of dollars on hardware.
Yeah.
You're subsidizing it. That doesn't cost you anything.
AI is the cost on AI all up front, or is it up front and then ongoing?
It's ongoing.
It's both.
It's both. Because you have to do the training. That's up front.
So it's not just that. So you're right. I'm sorry. When I inject like that, I'm not disagreeing. You're right.
No. I love that about you. You and I have a rhythm.
We're on the same.
Yeah,
we're on the same.
To my wife. Yeah. She punches me. So
you do it to me, and I love it because I'm like, yes, I'm like, you're right in my head.
Yeah.
So the ongoing cost of AI is tied to that transaction cost, right? It's the hardware right now. The infrastructure is very expensive. So one of the things that's happening as Microsoft is building out this infrastructure and offering all these AI services is that they're trying to lower the cost of AI. It's the same thing, a console market, right? We put out a piece of hardware. It's expensive. We're going to lose money. The goal is over time, we cost reduce this thing and we make a profit on it. They've never done that, but that's not their wheelhouse. Their wheelhouse is what they're doing right now. And so Microsoft, like Google, like Amazon, and that's it, is I guess Qualcomm sort of is doing this too. Designing data. Well, I know that's why data center based chipsets to handle AI as efficiently as possible.
Yes.
So that's part of the long term play. In the short term, we're building services and that we can sell to others. And
is this kind of research also valuable in that we'll get other technologies out of that, like, you know, Tang and Velcro, or is it really very very specific?
So if there, like, there'll be a branch of Microsoft that's like 3M that just kind of shows up with double-sided tape.
We figured out a way to make double-sided tape. Yeah.
Look at this. I like the BASF example better because you can watch their commercials, but you do not know what they
you guys might know the history of this better, but I would say in the case of the NASA-related stuff, I think that stuff kind of came out of it. It wasn't a plan in the beginning.
It wasn't the point. Right.
But there are great examples of research organizations starting up like AT&T did in the 70s, et cetera, with the specific aim of creating future technologies or something, you know?
I think it's a very reasonable assessment to say, now that you know you have these titanic machine learning workloads, building optimized hardware for it is money in the bank. And the byproduct from that could be
unique. It may be unforeseen. I mean, I Microsoft built HoloLens, didn't really have a clear use case for it. And I think the hope there was, we'll put this out in the world, and some third party's going to be like, oh my God, this is perfect for this thing that I just invented in my brain.
And it has turned up in a few verticals.
It has turned up, exactly. Yeah. The impact of AI is going to be much broader because it literally hits on every corner of the AI, you know, the whole tech world. So I think the chances of what Leo just asked, which I'd never thought of, it's brilliant, is pretty high. Yeah, that something could come out of this that we never anticipated. It will probably be an AI life form that subjugates us, but whatever, it will still be something.
No, we anticipate that. What we didn't anticipate is an AI that would make bubble gum out of tree leaves. Now you're talking something. Yeah.
We were trying to create this substance that would prevent an oil tanker from leaking oil into the ocean. And we created a delicious gum.
Could be a floor wax, could be a dessert topping.
If anything is going to do that, though, AI is, right? I mean, AI is so
100%.
That it, who knows what we're going to get out of that.
Well, I love it. You guys have both sent me down a path I never anticipated to. It's good.
Yeah. Like the Hansel and Gretel. I hope you leave breadcrumbs on the way.
There you go. Yeah.
So that's Microsoft's earnings in a nutshell.
It's a giant nutshell.
I mean, good Lord, $72 billion profit in a year.
They're doing okay.
More than $1 billion a week.
You'll be able to buy the entire B2 fleet.
I remember the stories in the early days of Microsoft when they really, I mean, they started raking it in really fast, really early. Mm-hmm. And they had no infrastructure. So Bill Gates would just take the money down to a bank and open a CD. And they had, for the first few years, there was a drawer somewhere with a bunch of bank books. This is our cash holdings. We can't touch them for a year.
So I mentioned that John Romero book last week. I'm much further into it. It's fantastic. And I'm going to get this number wrong, but when they got their first royalty check from Doom 2, which was their first retail product, they got a check. So he brought it down to the bank, and it was $7 million.
It was something like that. Yeah. Yeah.
And the guy was like, what the hell is this?
I can't catch like that.
Just deposit. He's like, I can't deposit. It's like, no, it's a check. Like there was a discussion at the bank. Like, what do we do with this? It's like, I guess you deposit.
Little tip. If you're going to deposit a big check, make sure it's a giant novelty check. For some reason, banks don't mind if you bring in
a
giant
novelty
check.
That's not going to fit in my drawer. Check. What is this? It's kind of funny. That's a nice problem.
What did they do? They bought Ferraris, isn't it? Isn't that what they did with that?
By the way, they bought Ferraris before that happened. They started paying themselves based on the money they were making off the shareware stuff.
Off the shareware side.
And it might have been Wolfenstein, not even Doom, where they had so much money. They were like, let's all give ourselves a $107,000 bonus because the Ferrari one was $106,000.
Right. And how long ago? They were Testarossa.
And this was, so those cars today would be close to $500 million probably or whatever that's cars amazing. Can cost today. But
it's amazing.
But they, that was just how they, and you know, there were four partners, I think, six. And it was like unanimous.
Does Microsoft, you think, at $30 a pop for Copilot make money, or is that a, is that even that too low to make money on it? I guess it depends on how
many
use it.
Depends on how many sign up.
It's like the gym, right? What you want is 100 people to sign up and only 50 use it.
If it's 100% utilization, probably not. But it's actually, it's maybe a better comparison because it's digital, is how many people use cloud storage. If everybody sucked up their terabyte of cloud storage, would OneDrive make any sense? Probably not, right?
It's not enough hard drives in the world.
So I don't know. I think God, all that we can do is speculate, right? As to the economics.
It's fascinating.
Clearly, it's got to be millions and millions of users, which they have. This is a question of how many they can get across the line. I think they're making that maneuver.
I think they're betting that this is such a hot thing that a lot of companies will buy it and never use it. Just like, we got to have that.
It's very interesting the reaction you get to this figure, because when you speak to individuals, like I've written an article on my website or whatever, and a bunch of people just who are individuals, they don't work in IT, they're not decision makers of big companies, whatever. They're like $30 a month per user.
That's crazy.
On top of, you have to have, you can't even do this. You have to have, like, I think it's E5 or higher, whatever the tier is.
E1, but an E3 is $36. Right. Okay. So you're literally doubling the price of an E3, which is the most common business.
Yeah. Some of these guys are paying $100 something a month per year. You know, it's crazy.
But it pays for itself. You're in a business. I know we do that in a business all the time. You know, we just bought a $24,000 mixer. Right. And as an individual, I'm going, $24K. Did we need that? Because we don't. It was redundancy. But. Right. It's a business, and so there's something about business expenses. It's not the same. It's not
the same scale. As you guys know, my wife makes a lot of cocktails. So she bought an industrial blender, fruit squeezer.
Things are great. We had one of those.
So we went to the restaurant store. The guy had to get it off the top shelf, and he said, "Do you own a restaurant or a bar?" And she said, "No, this is just for myself." And the guy goes, "Nice." So,
but in Spanish. So, yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome.
But for a business, when you look at this cost, whatever that works out, you know, annually over time, whatever it is, what you're really looking at is how many extra people would you have to employ?
How much?
Not just their salaries, but their benefits and the insurance and all the stuff. And as weird as it may sound to an individual, it actually makes sense.
Right.
Not in every single case.
Well, that's the thing is, can that thing save time to the tune of a dollar a day?
Right.
That's all. Give an employee. Yeah. That's all it really comes down to.
Yeah. And of course. And
that inherently is the benefit of AI, is the benefit of all tech, going back to whatever, steam trains, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the sort of myopic short-term view is, this is going to cost us jobs. Yeah, it is. Jobs shift because of technology. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. But it also enables individuals to be more efficient. Yeah, that means we need fewer of them.
Right.
Yes, that's a loss of jobs, but it's that kind of balance of pro and con, and the aim is to end up in the pro column when the dust settles.
Right. They say the same way that, you know, a calculator didn't take your job. It was a person with using a calculator to take your job. Right. And a large language model is not taking your job. A person using a large language model.
The shift from fossil fuels to whatever is causing people to lose their jobs here in the United States and certain parts of the country. Of course, those people are freaking out. And and when you go to them and say, learn how to write software code, you know, that's a stupid thing to say to someone who just lost a livelihood and this business is going away. Mm-hmm. It's also a technological advance. It falls in the same category. It's one of those greater good things. Like, it's not good for you. It's not good for this area. But, you know, this is, unfortunately, that the part of progress is things get left behind, you know. So it's just a reality.
Let me take a little break so we have time for all of our fine advertisers. Mm-hmm. But we will return with more of Windows Weekly, Paul Thurrott and Richard Campbell. But I have to pay for that $24,000 mixing console.
You sure do.
Actually, you know who really helps us a lot with this studio? Their sponsors, ACI Learning. When we started the year with ACI Learning sponsoring these side studios, I think a lot of people said, but you know IT Pro, and IT Pro is now merged with ACI Learning and has made this is a match made in heaven. Managed service providers, one of the many beneficiaries of ACI Learning. Are you an MSP? Let your team be entertained while they train with short format content. And now it keeps going up every time I do an ad, 7,200 hours to choose from. On demand, and not just on demand, but up to date. This lets your MSP team train with the information they need to become better at their jobs. Talk about something that pays for itself. I know you already know the name of IT Pro from our network. Now part of ACI Learning, IT Pro's expanded capabilities provide more support for MSP teams by keeping their courses updated in all aspects of IT. I mean, that includes MS Cloud, AWS, CompTIA, so much more. One proud MSP leader said, I had 110 engineers in the field. We had dozens of IT Pro accounts. Last year alone, they passed over 40 certs. They love it because they're learning. They're getting new skills, new things to put on their resume. You love it because your team is smarter and smarter all the time. That is a real competitive advantage. And speaking of advantages, ACI Learning's completion rate is over 80% on their videos. That's 50% higher than the industry average. That's because teams love it. It's entertaining, but it's educational. It's informative. It's engaging. It's passionate IT professionals sharing what they know, and that's the sweet spot. MSPs love the practice labs, too, not just because you can practice setting up Windows servers and clients in any HTML5 browser, but you can also use the labs to experiment before deploying new apps or updates without compromising a real live system. You'll love the ACI practice labs, where you can take the test before taking the real one. Prepare for challenging certification examinations with practice questions. Retake tests as many times as you need to make sure you're ready before sitting for the real deal. ACI Learning's new insights tool, oh, this is so cool, identifies weaknesses in your team so you know where to train. It provides management and individuals with assessments that are so valuable, helps you do your professional development planning, identify skills gaps, empower your team, personalize your training so that every gap is filled and they know they're perfect. They know it all. ACI Learning. It keeps your business from risking redundancy by consistently offering the most up-to-date certifications and courses available. It protects you with a personal account manager to make sure you aren't wasting anyone's time. Your account manager works with you to ensure your team only focuses on the skills that matter to your organization, so you can leave redundant training behind. Besides, nobody wants to watch a video of something they already know. It's not just redundant, it's boring. Make sure they're learning the things they need to know. And ACI Learning is ISO certified, so you know you're getting the world-class training your team deserves. Keep your team's IT skills up to date. Visit go.acilearning.com/twit. That's go.acilearning.com/twit. Twit listeners, it's a new offer. Listen up. At least 20% off, as much as 65% off an IT Pro Enterprise Solution plan. Discounts based on the size of your team. When you fill out the form on the website, you'll get a quote tailored to your needs. So to find out how much you'll save, go to go.acilearning.com/twit. MSPs, individuals, teams, IT teams, this is the place for you. The best training anywhere. go.acilearning.com/twit. And we thank them for supporting us. All right. Did we do the earnings thing or do we have?
Yeah, just I just want to go into a very detailed accounting of Google's earnings as well.
And I'll No. But how did the Goog do? Because I got to talk about it next show.
I'm going to do it in one sentence. And I don't care how many you wrote. I don't know. I don't even know. I'd have to go look it up. 79% of Google's revenues come from advertising.
Still.
It's an advertising 79%. Business. It always has been. Come on.
But this factors into the next big topic bucket here, which is AI. And the reason that Microsoft is getting into the AI stuff, which is what does the consumer AI business look for Microsoft? And we'll get to that in a second. I just wanted to say up front, because this comes up, you know, sometimes we beat these topics to death. AI and Activision Blizzard have been the two big examples this year. I know for some people it's like, man, you really talk about this stuff
a lot.
But
that's the news. I'm sorry. You don't have to justify it. That's what's
cool. But let's easily justify it by just saying that in the case of Activision Blizzard, obviously it's the biggest acquisition in Microsoft's history, and it impacts just a third, you know, a third of the company, if you will. Microsoft's trying to make a big business out of Xbox, which today is, you know, it's okay, but it's not doing great. It's it's impossible to me to think that people don't understand why that's important. But AI impacts all of Microsoft. AI is the growth engine that makes Microsoft today look like the tiny Microsoft of 1990 to us today, right? That this is the growth engine that is going to, this is the rising ships thing I keep talking about. It literally gets in, you know, into every part of Microsoft. The company that emerges on the other side of this is a much bigger and more powerful and different company than the one we have today. And, you know, it's all Microsoft. Yeah. So that's why.
Yeah. And earnings are important, but that's, I think it's also important. I think you made a really, to get back to your point, salient point, that Google's business is advertising.
Yeah. So
what is Microsoft's business? Is it cloud?
Yeah. There's two sides to it, right? There's the commercial side, which is cloud, which is, you know, big. But Microsoft came out with two announcements related to the cost of AI to customers last week or in the past couple of weeks. One was that the thing we just talked about, Microsoft 365 Copilot is going to cost $30 per month per user on top of whatever the other fees are. And Bing AI, it's actually called Bing Chat, but the AI-based capabilities of Bing will be free. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, it means that Bing is going to continue, as do other Microsoft services, and be ad-supported. And this is actually a big deal because in the same way that Apple is moving into services and has turned services now into their second biggest business, right, after the iPhone, Microsoft wants to, on the consumer side, move more into services. And it's not going to make money by selling individual, and a lot of money, Microsoft 365 subscriptions, OneDrive extra storage, whatever not, you know, like you can pay a little bit for Outlook so you don't get ads in the email stream or whatever. Like that stuff is not generating billions and billions of dollars. But if Microsoft could grow its ad business the way Google and Meta, Amazon, right, and these other companies have, this could become a next one of the next big businesses for Microsoft. And also it's the one... It impacts consumers, right? They don't really have a lot of success in the consumer space, frankly, overall, compared to the business stuff. So this is something I don't think anyone's ever talked about, you know, that when we complain in, except in peripheral ways, right? So when I complain about all the times that I'm using Windows 11 and Microsoft Edge pops up, even though that's not the browser I chose, when I tell you that this Windows 10 or Windows 11 Copilot, rather, Windows Copilot, is just an instance of Edge. That's all it is. It's you're running Edge even though you don't think you are, so that you can gain access to Bing and its AI capabilities, but be confronted by Microsoft's tracking, Microsoft's online services, Microsoft's advertising engine, right? This is all about bulking up this thing that they want to be a big business. They want to compete with Google. Like when Microsoft says that we hope that Bing AI will make us more competitive to Google search, what they're really saying is we want to be competitive with the way that Google search makes money, which is advertising. That's what they're really doing. And I ran into this. I'll try to get to this quickly, but this was kind of an amazing thing. We all have that version of a story where two of us are talking about some topic and then we start seeing ads on our phones. I'm like, oh my God, my phone's listening to me. Or I had the example from 2-3 years ago where I bought a pair of sneakers and then only ads for those sneakers would pop up and everywhere online for me, even though I'd already bought them. And that's how stupid advertising is. So I wrote an article that I haven't published yet where I talk about this thing that I bought, which I've never mentioned to anybody. And I had to go back on Amazon to find it so I could get the exact name and link to it or whatever. And then over the next several days, I started noticing in my Google Discovery feed, which is all tech news stories, in case you missed it, a review of this exact product from 9 months ago. It was the only thing like that. There were no other in case you missed it about old things. It was only this one product. It happened every day for 3-5 days, whatever it was. And, you know, look, conspiracy theories are fun, you know, blah, 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 whatever. But I'm sorry.
Search is not a conspiracy theory.
Yeah. And this is, and I'm using Brave, right? So I can't say that the browser would have blocked what it can block. But the thing is, I went to Amazon and looked it up while signed in.
Right.
Amazon grabbed that thing and blew it out into the universe and said, do what you will with this guy's personal information. Google caught it and ran to the touchdown and showed me a bunch of stories about this thing because it found out from Amazon that I was interested in this product. Even though Amazon knew I already bought it and there was no need for me to know more about it. But that's this kind of connection, which today I think is stupid, is one of the many, many things we just talked about this, which will be made better by AI. And AI could make advertising is scary. It sucks, but it could make AI more, make advertising even more lucrative for the third parties that are buying these services from today, Facebook or Meta, Google and Amazon.
I would argue that we're currently in an advertising crisis as it has become quite ineffective and problematic.
Yeah, but what if if Microsoft can say, look, we did it.
Yeah,
we can make this effective. And our little tiny share goes up to a big share.
Well, this whole advertising model was based on you typing in a search expression, right? You're searching for something. It's product related. I'll show you ads. You think about what people type to a Copilot.
I know.
You know, then that's what value that would have.
That's what advertising. Yeah, exactly. It's so much more. There's a fundamental disconnect, and this is smart people that people just disagree on this topic. I would argue very strenuously. I know it's hard to imagine me arguing anything strenuously, personalized advertising is bad, that you need to stop giving your personal information away, that you should be paid for this. And other people are like, I don't care. I'd rather see something I like than an ad for something I don't care about. And it's like, I'd rather you didn't see any ads at all, but that's just
but you're not willing to pay for the product of being able to find things. So
yeah,
you have to find a revenue stream somehow, but I'm with you. These machine learning models open the door to more targeted advertising.
I use this example a lot. I just think this is beautiful. I think this puts this in perspective. I want you to think about the future of Microsoft's AI offerings. There's a commercial, a business side and a consumer side. Mm-hmm. The commercial side is built on per user per month subscription fees. It's a kind of a direct model. You pay for service and you get a service. It's nice. The other side, this consumer side, is advertising based. Conceivably, there are far more people seeing these ads than there are people paying for that direct service.
Yeah.
But the disparity between the revenues you get from the subscription versus the revenues you get from the ads are incredibly vast. Mm-hmm. And I see this at Throt.com with the premium offering we have. I'm sure Leo sees it with the Club Twit. Mm-hmm. But Spotify, God bless them, they're super transparent. So they give you the numbers. So Spotify, they just announced their quarterly earnings as well. They have 551 million total monthly users, of which 220 million, 40% are paid subscribers, and 317, 60% are ad supported.
Right.
40% of their 40% of their user base generates 88% of their revenues.
Exactly.
That's the difference. Mm-hmm. So you get 60% contributing 12% of the revenues. The revenues that they make are from subscribers is $2.8 billion in a quarter. The revenues they make from ads is $404 million.
Yeah. You might as well make the ads horrible. Because, yeah. I mean, if they took away the ads entirely, why would anybody subscribe?
So
you need to make the advertising experience so bad, you want to subscribe.
Yeah. Some blogger asked Microsoft if they were ever going to charge for Bing. And they said, no, never. You know, we're not doing that. And so I think, you know, I don't know, Windows Copilot is so dumb and so just Bing that my guess on Windows, but according to Microsoft, a fact, generally speaking, they're going to just do the ad supported route, right?
Yeah. The question here is always, what are you going to do with the Copilot? How do you make the Copilot great? Yeah. Which really is, how do you provide me information I would have a tough time finding either way? Give me a better interface to my goal.
Yeah, we talk a lot about that Stevie Batiche moment at Build 2023, where he talked about the three phases in which AI occurs over Microsoft product. First phase, of course, is the side-by-side, which is the Copilot. And, Windows Copilot almost doesn't even meet the standard of that because it already exists in the sense that we can go to a website and get it. We can use Microsoft Edge and have a sidebar and get it, or we can just turn on Windows Copilot in the near future and get it that way. Those three things are all the same thing.
Yeah, LLMs as a search tool as opposed to LLMs as a navigation through product. Like the Windows Copilot you want is the one that's virtually impossible to build, which is I describe a goal and you harness available tools for me to achieve that goal. It's not necessarily, you know, a search result. It's, well, we should use this app and that app and like the composition of a goal.
I just think
that that's an operating system is a host for applications. And so if you could describe a goal and it could take your applications and help you get to that goal, that's great. So, I just don't think they can make that. That's an impossible thing to make.
I wrote a an editor. I don't know if it's linked. It must be linked in here somewhere. I made the case. Well, maybe I shouldn't short circuit this. Let me just see where if it's in here. But I made the case that I guess it isn't in here. So let's talk about it. The thing that got Microsoft in trouble in the late 1990s with antitrust regulators specifically was the bundling of Internet Explorer, or what we should call web technologies, into Windows, right? They intermeshed these things in a way that was unnatural.
Well, they said they would intermesh. Yeah, they said they were intermeshed, whether they were or not. I mean, IE was always an app.
But it culminated in an explosion of stupidity with like the Internet Bar, or whatever it was called, the Channel Bar, and the Active Desktop, but whatever. So that's all kind of scaled back, and we did what we did. But, you know, you flash forward 20 years, 25 years, whatever it is, and Windows 11 is becoming that thing again. The integration of the Microsoft Copilot, which is just Microsoft Edge, the forced usage of Microsoft Edge for certain things like search highlights results or when you click on something in widgets is kind of an example of the same thing. There's no reason those things could not open in another browser, but Microsoft has a business reason to force you. Which we may, you know, we don't like maybe or don't care about, doesn't matter, but they're doing
it. They decided that they are digital effluent from using a browser is valuable.
I love it. Yes, it is effluent. That's good. So here we are again. Everything's coming around full circle. We're integrating more. The browser name has changed, but at a high level, it's the same thing.
I am disappointed. My thought when they went Chromium Edge was, right, hey, you're the renderer is going to be the same. It's the host is going to be different. Mm-hmm. Like, I would happily pay a fee to have my effluent contained.
So right to that point, Microsoft's promise, which I read as, we're going to take Chrome, strip all of the Google stuff out of it, end of sentence.
Yeah.
But left unsaid, we're going to put some Microsoft stuff in there to replace it. And you're like, oh, that's okay. I trust my Microsoft account. Syncing browser settings through my Microsoft account is cool. There's no reason not to do that. I was already actually doing it anyway in the past, right? So, yeah, okay, that sounds good. But the thing they didn't talk about, because they were busy promoting how it blocks trackers and stuff like that, you know, huge UI and all that stuff that actually doesn't do a thing, was that they're also replacing all the tracking stuff with their own tracking stuff. Right. So instead of Google tracking you, it's Microsoft. And again, I don't want to get into this kind of, you know, some people think personalized ads are good and bad and different. Like, you could make an argument, if you're going to be tracked, you might as well be tracked by someone who knows what they're doing, right? Maybe,
I'm sorry, you might as well. This equation knows what they're doing?
Google, because their ad business is 79% of their revenues. And a big chunk of that comes from this tracking that they do in Chrome and in Android, right?
Right.
Yes. I mean, that's, they're really good at it. They've honed this, you know? So there you go. Anyway, I think that stuff is kind of interesting, and so tied to this, all of the major AI players have kind of met with the White House. They've agreed to this, standards for safeguards and all this kind of stuff, like, cause everyone's afraid about the Planet of the Apes scenario where AI destroys the earth and yada, yada, yada. And that's fun. But I think the worry I'm coming to is the thing I just described, that AI is really going to be used on the consumer end to make this tracking stuff work better. It's going to make AI, the very nature of this is to take all these data points and pull it into this thing that makes sense. So of course they're going to do this on the back end and sell that to advertisers, right?
At the same time, it's not even hard to do. All I have to do is convince you to explain to me what you're intending to do. And I have the most useful information everybody else is trying to derive.
Yep. And when you look at the White House, they're not guidelines, but the recommendations that we're making for AI safeguards, they're all based on this scary stuff. Mm-hmm. The word privacy, I think, only comes up twice. And it's with regards to this notion that AI should never be used to find out something about a human and then disparage that person online and tell lies about it. That's what they mean by privacy. It's not talking at all about the thing I just talked about.
Right.
And I'm sure all these AI companies like, we got it. Yep. You want
You're
us
good.
To
sit, guys? That we sounds got it. Good.
No one's going to mention the real aim of this back in the corner of the room, you know, behind the curtain or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. Which is, AI is going to be used nefariously, just like whatever technology we have today is used nefariously make Google
and
into
nefarious being an opportunity to sell your information for their profit.
You can just follow the chain of, nobody reads EULAs, So we agreed to this, you know, to where we got today.
It's just another version of you are the product because you're not paying.
Yeah. Right. Yes. Thank you. That's exactly right. All right. Let's move beyond the weighty topics.
Was that a weighty topic?
I think it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
The notion that AI is sneakily going to be used to track you around the internet and then help advertisers actually know something about you. Yeah.
At least we don't have to worry about it taking over the world, though. I mean, I think that's the good news.
No, that's Bill Gates told us last week. We're fine. I'm not even worried about it anymore.
Fine. Yeah. It's all fine. Yeah. Yeah.
From the mouth of Bill to the mind of Paul. It's fine.
It's fine. Okay.
So the rest of this AI stuff is not nonsense, but it is just basic news.
It's productization.
Yeah.
Why the Bing chatbot exists in Chrome and Safari, I cannot imagine.
I know, like, this makes me crazy. So when Bing Chat came out, you had to use Microsoft Edge to go to the website and use it. You had to, right? Now, there were people who figured out little workarounds that, but, again, they're trying to drive usage of the browser, which drives usage of the services, which drives usage of their ad engine.
And one would argue that Bing Chat is a way to drive usage of the services still without having to change the browser.
That's the thing. So, okay. But, you know, this is going to change over time. You know, people are going to have workarounds, whatever. So, yeah, this week they announced that they were opening it up to users on Chrome and Safari. Mm-hmm. Why? Why not just open it up? What is it about Brave that, well, actually, there is something about Brave, isn't there? Because Brave blocks a lot of stuff by default. I don't know. But I it's crazy to just make it available. Me and three other people use Brave. Who cares? It's a Chromium-based browser. You know, it's like, I'm stealing cable. So what? I don't, not many people do it. You know, I don't actually steal cable. Anyway, so that happened. I don't know. Chrome and Safari are the world's two most popular web browsers. If you lump mobile and desktop together. So, okay. Related to this, ChatGPT has been available on Android in certain markets. It's available in the US and a couple of other markets now. So if you were waiting to do AI stuff on the go, I guess you could do that now. Who cares? And then more interesting to me, and I think maybe to Richard too, because this is basically literally a developer topic, is Microsoft in the past has talked about something called, well, first of all, Microsoft has a product called GitHub Copilot.
Right.
Right. And this is a way, you can, you know, generate code and,
arguably the first of the large language products.
Yeah. And it's, you know, instead of going to Stack Overflow or, you know, Googling things, you use this product and it takes the aggregate knowledge of the internet and gives you answers. Okay. Microsoft has had a plan for the past, I don't know when they announced it, but maybe it was billed last year, but they've been talking about this thing called GitHub Copilot X, which is kind of like the future vision of Copilot on GitHub. And there's three parts to this. AI backed chat experience, Copilot for pull requests, and then AI generated answers about documentation, right?
Right.
And there's a command line interface and yada, yada, yada. So this past week,
they know. Is there a word X in there? Doesn't Elon own X?
It looks like everybody but Elon owns X.
I think it's hysterical. Yeah. Both Meta and Microsoft have trademarks for X.
Mm-hmm. So my guess is that GitHub Copilot in the future will be called GitHub Copilot. It will, in fact, change the name. But what will happen is the kind of things that make it up will expand and improve, and we'll have that X experience, whatever. This week, they announced the first of those GitHub Copilot X vision to reality services. And it's a feature of, it's like so many, the same words over and over again. The paid service is called GitHub Copilot for Business. Mm-hmm. Also, I'm sorry, there's one called just GitHub Copilot for Individuals. By the way,
that's the definition of AI, the same words over and over again.
Yeah. So we're just talking 10 to 20 bucks a month, depending on who you are.
Right.
they've introduced a feature for both called GitHub Copilot Chat Beta. So that's the chat component of X that we were talking about. And the idea there is that you can literally from within the editor of your choice, but Visual Studio Code for most people, I would imagine Visual Studio, chat with an AI and not just get code samples, but do far more other things. And I'd have to read the list to kind of go through what that means. But what do you know about this, Richard? Because you're probably in a much better place.
I mean, the original product from back in June 2022 was really them applying a machine learning model to publicly available code on GitHub, mm-hmm. so that you effectively could search it more efficiently. What you're seeing it now, what you're seeing now in these next pieces is chat style interfaces, new user interfaces to the services that surround making code, GitHub Actions, deployment, and so forth. Parsing code, your own code, to write summaries of it. Like, everybody runs into the same problem when it goes to put up a pull request. It's like, what the hell did I just do over the past 3 days? Like, you don't remember.
Or even something like document this.
Yeah, so you which know? Effectively what you, this is all about, yeah. documenting ultimately.
Right.
So
right.
The fact that the machine can summarize all the code changes you made, and so that you go from that blank screen of what's my pull request to this is too much detail and I need to edit it. Or it's, you know, even misinterpretations. You get rid of the blank screen. The thing that I've found consistently with ChatGPT that it's good at is write me a polite way to tell this person to take a hike. And then, you know, rather than have a blank screen, I have a long thing that I edit down. So there's the creating of documentation and there's the interacting with the interfaces. And so being able to get into a deploy, into a push, all of those sorts of things.
The interesting thing to me here is ties back to the Stevie Patish thing and the notion of side-by-side co-pilots and that's what a co-pilot is. And this is what this is, because it is a co-pilot, not on screen, but literally in the editor that you are using, right?
Where you're working. Yeah.
And that's a great Microsoft thing under Satya Nadella.
Yeah. But you see the three distinct parts. There's fetching data from multiple sources to give you ideas. On where to go, like, for instance, fetching code. There's the taking what you've already done and summarizing or expressing it in a useful way. Mm-hmm. And there's the interaction with the workspace itself. Instead of using menus and buttons, you know, being able to express it.
Conversational chat. Right. Yeah. I assume there is a part of that first component, which is the fetching of code, that will allow an AI to, or in this case, GitHub Copilot, to examine the code you've written and make it more efficient.
Well, that's a side of that, is getting into, is there refactoring? Is there a known pattern for this? You know, when you start to think about what Microsoft's, you know, why has Microsoft been successful in this industry? It's the tooling, right?
I need a developer assistant that is basically my personality, so it's snarky, who can say something to me like, Paul, your use of 27 embedded if-then loops is funny, but we were thinking.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you could go in this direction.
There's a refactor explorer there, right? And so now you get into what Microsoft's often done, which is this IntelliSense effect, right? That it's continuously compiling the code you're writing and marking where it thinks this isn't going to function correctly, this isn't going to work. So can we step that up another level? There's an interesting angle to this, which is, could I, as a professional developer or known developer, build up a style sheet that is expressed in a large language model that is evaluating your code and saying it's, you know, not complying to the style?
Yeah, I'm positive that will come. That has to come.
A highly secure coding approach, for example.
Or even just a corporate guideline thing, which will happen in large organizations with teams. You know, yeah, I could see that.
And so rather than having it at the end of coding, it's a set of criticisms, you know, in the form of warnings.
Yeah, you're writing in the right way, the correct way for your organization.
Right? Yeah, that it gets you into the pattern of writing it by catching you as you go, right? The way that a Grammarly is, you know, constantly marking.
And every organization has its rules for how it wants you to write code. Going back,
it's just a question of when it's enforced.
Yeah. This ties exactly back to that thing we talked about earlier with jobs and job loss and all that kind of stuff. You as an individual becoming more responsible, because in the power today, you might have at a big company a group of people or a person who actually examines code and says, "Hey, did you read the TPS report? Yeah. You're not using the style." So I guess we're eliminating his job, but the thing is, overall, the organization and you as an individual are made more efficient by.
Well, and this is what I'm finding talking to developers who've embraced a bunch of these technologies, is that where they once would have needed a code review or had waited or talked to someone else to build a particular piece, the tooling is helping them get through that stuff quicker. And so
Microsoft was early in that. Remember Hungarian notation, Charles Simonius? Well,
mechanisms, and IntelliSense being the classic, 25 years old now.
Yeah.
Getting more and more advanced.
It keeps it standardized so the next guy can come along and understand what you're doing. And
Old Visual Studio today, does it? I don't know if this falls under the onus of IntelliSense, but you write code in full Visual Studio, get a little flag on it, you mouse over it, pops up and says, blah, blah, blah. This, it will give you these kinds of hints. This could be more efficient, or, try this. You can, there's a way to format the code that maybe rearranges some parameters in a way that's more efficient, probably for the underlying compiler or whatever it is. And, I'm fascinated by those. I don't always agree with them, right? I actually don't always want to use their recommendation, but I guess that's the point. I don't always use Grammarly's recommendations either when I write.
Sure.
It's Grammarly.
Well, one of the conversations I've had over the years with guys like Mads Torgersen and so forth is, what do you do?
You said Mads Torgersen, C Sharp maintainer.
Yeah, the guy who leads C Sharp. But what do you do when you're 12 versions of C Sharp in and someone's still running C Sharp like it's 2005? Because his code will work.
I bet it will.
So, they haven't broken a thing for the most part.
But actually, that is one of the instances in which the type of thing I was talking about will come up. You're using an out-of-date code style.
Yeah.
And it will suggest something modern. It doesn't say, hey, this debuted in C# 11 or something. That's why you should, but it will make that suggestion.
Yes.
And I think that type of stuff, if it happens enough to you, you'll just start making it, you'll write it that way yourself.
Yeah. And you're exactly right. And that's the intent is don't catch it at code review. Don't catch it even at compile.
No, do it proactively.
As you're writing.
That's right. Yep. Always better to get it right up front.
Mm-hmm. So that
if it compiles, that's fine too.
Close enough, right? But it does compile.
Yes.
Well, that's the difference between idiomatic and compiling, right? I'm always looking to write idiomatic code. That's the term they use. Okay. Where if you're writing in C#, there's a style way to do it. It has nothing to do with compiling or even accuracy. It's just a style.
It's just a style guide, essentially. Yeah.
Guide. And so Google has style guides for all their languages. I'm sure Microsoft does too.
Mm-hmm. I don't have the language to describe this properly, but the way I think of it is when I write code, I just want code to be readable. So I don't mind code to be a little more wordy, whatever. I want to be able to look at this and know what it means. So sometimes when they make the code, the refactoring on you and you're like, I don't know what this is. I would not have written it this way.
Yeah, when I wrote this, it was only me and God. Now only God knows.
That's right.
I just hate it when people leave a parenthesis alone on a line in Lisp. It just drives me nuts.
Yeah, it should be a curly brace.
a semicolon at least.
And a semicolon, yeah.
Exactly. But we talked today about having sufficient performance, and the maintainability represents the larger issue. And so legible code is becoming.
Yeah, I would rather have
more legible, more maintainable code than the highest performance code.
And
we'll often mark up a block that says, okay, I had to make performance compromises in this code. So the reason this isn't legible is that it's very, very fast.
Yeah, put that in a statement, a comment. So when someone complains about it later, they'll understand.
Oh, and that's what the comment up front is like, you shouldn't understand this code. It was insane to write.
Yeah.
And nobody really sure why it works.
Right. Yeah. Right. You don't want that.
There's a very famous piece of Unix code that just showed up the other day as a conversation of literally was marked with a comment that says, this should not make sense to you.
Yeah.
There's no reason to understand this.
Please don't waste your time on this.
I think there's a title of a book about coding. I remember reading. I'm trying to remember the name of it.
Once upon a time when I did real work, and admittedly that's a long time ago, we did a lot of performance tuning on web-related stuff, trying to make websites go faster and faster. And often I would mark up a block of code. And the classic one is a cache expiry validation, where the code seems irrational until you can think in multi-threaded, multi-state behavior, which like three people can do. All I know is how to cut and paste it. And so you would put at the top of the comments, like, if this code doesn't make sense to you, do not touch it.
Yeah, don't touch it. That's actually a better language to have there, right?
Yeah.
It's not that you shouldn't understand this. Yeah. If you don't understand this.
It's the most famous comment in the history of Unix. You are not expected to understand this.
That's the one, the context switching code. Yeah. And when you read it, you're like, I feel so much better not understanding.
Because I don't.
It's like a line of code, and it's horrifying.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I love it.
But that's not good code if you're working in a team. That's not what you want.
No. Well, it's hopefully what they did was they started out readable and gave up readability to make it more efficient or performant or whatever. But at least document how it works, or how you got there.
Write as legibly as you can, and when you cannot, mark carefully.
Right. Okay.
And then Apple.
Apple. We're going to go through this one in 3 seconds. Apple is rumored to be working on its own ChatGPT because, of course, they are. And
well, they're so big in cloud.
They do. The thing is, Apple is obviously the biggest company in the world. They have tons of data centers. Mm-hmm. Right now, those things are designed to serve apps to their users and stuff like that. You know, their online services. They're not really for AI that we know of, by the way. Secretive company, so you never know. Mm-hmm. I guess the two sides of this are, one, never discount Apple. That would be dumb. But two, they usually take time to come to market. And they usually pick their time. They usually show up when they can add value. And I guess the one negative outcome here could be that this thing arrives like Apple Maps and is a joke. I guess we'll see. I would think that experience would prevent that because
or the first three Apple TVs.
Yeah. So we'll see. But this is only a rumor. Apple's never discussed it. Apple's developer show came and went with no mention of this in June. So
they would be chasing it. They had mentioned it. So they try not to do that though.
Yeah.
Then again, so we thought they were ready with an AR product too.
Yeah. A lot of my readers, you know, look, I'm very critical of Apple. I have my reasons. But a lot of people are even critical beyond like where I am. And they would say things, oh, Apple is just a copycat. You know, these copy things, you know, like the copy of the MP3 player, the copy of the smartphone, you know, it's like, yeah, that's not what they did. They do come into existing markets, but they do it when they can add value and when they think they have something that's significantly better. And they don't always hit that mark, but they do a lot. No.
And sometimes they do hit that mark and consumer.
And we're still living with one of them today, the iPhone, which is changed the world. So just don't discount them. That's all.
Yeah.
You can hate them if you want. I get it. But don't be stupid about it.
Yeah. We either join the cult or you make fun of the cult, one or the other.
Right. I mean, they're wearing white sneakers and they're going to heaven in a spaceship. But you know what? There they might be onto something. I don't know. Who could say? Okay.
Yeah, Windows. Drink this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you got the little Dixie cup on the way into the Apple store. You'll be fine.
let's pause here for the station identification all along the Twit Broadcast Network. All right. Continuing on. Oh, wait a minute. I have to wait a couple of beats. 2, 3, 4. Okay. Continuing on.
Unbeknownst to everybody, but beknownst to me, yesterday passed, came and went without nary a mention of something I was expecting. Not the earnings, which everyone was expecting, but rather the preview version of the update that Microsoft will ship on Patch Tuesday next month, right? This past Tuesday was week D.
Oh.
So they did ship, oddly, a week D preview update for Windows 11 version 21H2, which is the first version of Windows 11, still supported through October, but not for 22H2. I'm like, oh, this. And you know, again, every show almost, I'm like, I think I figured out the schedule. I document it. I explain why I think it's the way it is. And then every friggin' month, they screw with it. And
they do something.
So this one, I think, was just a one-off, no big deal. But they actually released it today. In fact, they released it while Leo was doing the ad, the first ad in the show.
That's why I do them. I put them in there to give Microsoft a chance to ship.
Yeah, so otherwise, I didn't install it, obviously. I'd have to reboot. All right, so here's the deal. This year, I, without exception, he says, asterisk, because I'm not 100% positive, but I believe, there has not yet been a preview update of a Patch Tuesday update that didn't include at least one new feature. One month it was one new feature. It was that switch in Windows Update to get the updates early. Remember, that was the one month it was one feature. But this month, they just shipped it today. There are no new features. Lots of fixes and updates, things like, you know, updates an issue that blah, 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 or does something, you know, this update makes brightness settings more accurate, that kind of thing. But there's no like feature I can point to. So I don't know if it's because we're kind of lurching toward 23H2 slash moment four, but I believe this is the first month coming. The next month will be the first month where we have a Patch Tuesday without a new feature in Windows 11 22H2. I think. So there you go.
Well, it's almost Windows 23 time, right?
Yes, it is, because last week they shipped a new build to the Windows Insider Beta channel and said, this is going to be Windows 11 23H2.
There you go.
So we are now barreling to that. And there are new features coming into that. So remember, we talk about, I just said it, but this notion that Moment 4, which would have been the next quarterly release for Windows 11 version 22H2, is the same as Windows 11 version 23 H2, because that release is being released as an enablement package, which is a very minor update. It will expose new features that have actually been shipped under the covers in previous updates. It's just like a moment. It is a moment. It's a moment. So we're going to get that new File Explorer home view that has looks a lot like if you've ever been to OneDrive.com, they have like recommended things at the top and templates and favorites and recents and all that stuff. Kind of like the Office / Microsoft 365 app in Windows is like that. And then a bunch of minor stuff, dynamic lighting settings, Windows Ink improvements, the new volume mixer, which rips off one of Raphael's tools called Ear Trumpet, Windows Spotlight wallpapers, right, where you have Windows Spotlight now on the lock screen, those pretty pictures, but now you can have them on the desktop, which you can actually kind of do with a theme, but now you can actually get information about them like you can on the lock screen. I think that's kind of fun. Passkey support we talked about with that built-in thing on the notification toast where you can get the interact with the passkey and also do like the 2FA codes and all that kind of stuff. And then just, small stuff. It's just small stuff. So that's what we know so far. I don't expect to see this change dramatically. I think Windows 11 23 H2 is going to arrive rather tamely. I got to tell you, I have spent the literally a year now writing a book about Windows 11, focusing obviously on 22H2 from the get-go, even though it wasn't out at the time. The book just crossed the 900-page mark. The least that Microsoft could change Windows 11 at this point, the better for me.
Yeah,
selfishly.
Time so for a new UI.
That's what I'm saying. God, I'm not gonna do physical harm to myself, but it's fair to say my mind goes.
It's physical harm to somebody.
So anyway, the first explicit release of a 23H2 thing to the beta channel happened late last week. Today or yesterday, I think it was today, they released an update that doesn't add any new features, but it's just bug fixes, which indicates to me this thing is starting to happen. This where they're starting to, it's the very end of July. We're heading right into August. This is when it needs to be finished. So that is going to happen pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Do you know anything about this AMD thing? Okay. Maybe you could talk to us a bit because this,
it's very much like Spectre and Meltdown. I mean, you back to the same old problem, which is that you're making optimizations in caching that expose potential vulnerabilities. You're trying these long CPU pipelines all have similar problems. Admittedly, AMD pipelines are shorter than Intel pipelines.
Right.
And so you try and pre-position data that might be needed for that pipeline so that it doesn't have to go through a
predictive fashion or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
To speed up the performance.
And it doesn't, at the CPU level, that all memory is flat. So there's no concept of a security boundary on it. So in any of these contexts, it's possible for it to fetch data that a given process shouldn't have a right to access it. Now, these are incredibly it is hard to describe the vulnerability. It would be crazy hard to implement a tool that would take advantage of it. But it is the nightmare scenario where I could be running a chunk of code in a very restricted environment, but on that CPU and pulling bits of memory from anything else that could be running in that CPU.
God knows where it came from, but it's sitting there in the CPU.
Exactly. And so now put that in the context of a cloud, right? Where I can set up a VM running in a cloud and I can basically peek into memory of anything else that could be running on that machine from on any other cloud client. And somebody's asking what the name of the vulnerability is. It's called Zen Bleed. And it is... I mean, and let's not make fun of
named after
here.
The AMDs. No, but I will point out one thing. I bet a lot of people forget is that when Spectre Meltdown happened several years ago, AMD, I foolishly, and I called them out on this at the time, sort of bragged that, this doesn't
happen to us. Right?
Stupid Intel. Like, this is a belated bit of karma, perhaps. I really like AMD. I love what they're doing with microprocessors. Be careful.
Yeah. This is a very, very large glass house and everybody has a rock, right? It's like, come on.
Yep.
So it's the same class of vulnerability. It is very unlikely to be exploited, but the consequences if it was successfully exploited can be extraordinarily damaging. And so you got to figure it out. And the price it's a microcode fix, which is not difficult to fix.
This is just a proof of concept right now. There's no known.
It's not even a proof of concept. There is a speculative vulnerability based on cache exploitation. Nobody's even built a prototype. There's no zero day.
I'm going to get AI going on that. I bet AI can fill it out, figure it out.
The fix will be a microcode update, and it'll impact performance. Plain and simple.
Just like Spectre.
So this is MITRE and Spectre and Meltdown and all those.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the same class of problem for exactly the same reason, should end up with the same kind of fix, and it's just a hit to performance.
See what happens. That's what happens.
And this is why we can't have nice things.
Right. Well, and then just two minor points related, and this is related to the devices business inside of more personal computing at Microsoft that happens to be Surface and HoloLens. And both of these, I'm just like, I don't know why. Microsoft is apparently...
I need something to buy.
Oh, well, this might be it then. So a Surface Studio Laptop 2 could be coming this fall. This is the replacement for the Surface Book, which is what Richard is using right now.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, it's a nice laptop.
Between myself and She Who Must Be Obeyed is that when we finally have completed the move... Yeah. We will get new laptops. And she works heavily in CAD, so she needs horsepower more than I even.
Aside from the screen rotating nonsense.
Yeah, the this big floppy difference, screen thing.
Well, but the big difference between Surface Studio laptop and Surface laptop is the GPU, right?
Right.
And, you know, it's not like a high-end workstation GPU. We don't know what the next version will have. But it's, you know, for a lot of the work you do, honestly.
More than enough for me. She could probably use even more. But going from 11 gen to 13 gen is not a small skip up,
I
would hold out for an ARM, personally. But, I mean, she's currently living on a Lenovosaurus on one of the T classes.
It's 11th gen, you said?
She probably has
an H series something with a GPU. And
that's right.
Lots of, yeah. Okay.
And I dropped a 3090 in her workstation, and she sure felt the difference. Like, nice. A smoking piece of hardware priced accordingly.
Yep.
There's no way a laptop's ever going to keep up with that of any class. So, until you start looking at some of the things like the modular laptops, where I literally can put one of the RTXs into it.
Leo discussed a couple of weeks ago, you're looking at a several months long wait.
Easily.
You get a new framework is next year.
And therein lies the real problem, which is when we finally pull the trigger on it, we'll have exactly about a week's worth of patience.
I don't think it's 3090 class anyway. It's an AMD.
No.
It's a Radeon.
No, but...
Yeah, I'm not. I wouldn't go down AMD path for any of that.
Yeah.
Just for the Nate, I know the product that she's relying on is optimized for RTX. So
she needs a video. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't.
And I'd love to get my hands on an ARM laptop. I mean, I would suffer.
I'm curious. I still think that.
Is that because of the battery life, Richard? Why?
No, it's MPU.
Yeah. It's everything, right?
It's everything.
And it's also, it appeals to the gadgetness. I'd like to be in on that early. And
They say this fall, which I mean Qualcomm.
And I bought a Book One and it kicked my butt as well, right?
I went through two of them because they were so bad. There's this Nuvia influenced version of the chipsets that are going to come out in probably next year at the earliest. I just hope it's not late next year. So I guess the point is Qualcomm usually announces this stuff end of year. Just see what they say. ARM is suing them because they're going into PC chips. That's scary. We'll see. So let's see how that shakes out. I wouldn't get a current gen Qualcomm anything right now, personally. But
yeah, we have to wait. And it's the question of how long it can stand to wait. But
yep.
Do you need I'm ready for a new laptop. That being said, I'm pretty close to just paving this thing anyway, because I want to go for the full M365 curation. The old servers in the server closet will be turned off in the next month.
Yeah.
Forever.
Well, you realize some benefits from paving it anyway. Like it's not like you got a new PC, but I mean it's
clearing out the arteries. It's a little bit of an angioplasty. You know, all software is.
I was thinking of it as more of a colon blow, but this is the same idea.
Whatever end you want to work from. You know. But it's still got the residuals of Active Directory in it, and being a pure AED implementation M365 machine makes a difference.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Huge overhead difference. Yep.
Well, I did build us new 13 gen workstations. We each got one, and those were AED from the outset. And can log into the Active Directory, but they don't authenticate there. They authenticate in the cloud. And I'm not doing a domain junk because the domain is going away. It's vintage. It was an updated PDC from 2000, for crying out loud. It still has front page credentials in it. So it'll be good to have that turned off once and for all.
Yeah, right. Good.
All right.
All right.
So HoloLens news. I love it. So exciting.
No, it's just, I don't even know what to say to this.
It's so exciting.
Hot in the heels of the news that the Army has determined the HoloLens is absolutely worthless to their needs, they are apparently testing a new version of it. This might be a contractual thing. We knew Microsoft was the only real work going on with HoloLens right now is improving the thing that they're trying to get to the Army. Apparently, some milestone has been reached, and now 20 prototype 1.2 goggles have been delivered. And I
think they're exploiting the Army to experiment with new hardware, waiting for hardware for enough TikToks to go by to get the hardware results they want. These devices are really expensive. You're not going to get to update them every year. It's been four years.
And
it has been a while. And that's at least two TikToks, right?
And by the way, speaking of ARM, if I'm not mistaken, HoloLens 2 was ARM. And, not that HoloLens 1 was like a barn burner or whatever, but I think the next release is going to be a significant, performance improvement, I would hope.
Yeah, longer battery life, full field of view, lighter.
Right. I actually think going into battle, what would be scarier is people wearing those Apple things with the fake eyes on the outside.
Oh, yeah.
I think
that would, right? Send people go running. Red, you're in war mode. Excuse me.
Not as dry here. Because I guess at least one complaint last week about the Activision Blizzard stuff, I decided to break out Activision Blizzard into its own section this week. Screw you. And but I did move it away from the top of the thing. It's interesting how everything kind of reached a crescendo. Actually, we'll get to this. But the first thing I did, and I alluded to this earlier, I couldn't find it, but here it is, was I looked at what would the last year have looked like for Microsoft financially if it owned Activision Blizzard. And did nothing, right? In other words, we just take their money, put it in, And I mentioned earlier, good timing with the quarterly revenues that Microsoft's more personal computing business is the smallest of the three that it has. And when you add the revenues from Activision Blizzard in, more personal computing is still the smallest business Microsoft has, right? Mm-hmm. There was one exception, and that was the holiday quarter, which makes sense, right? Video games. But by $0.01 billion, they were basically even. So
mere $10 million. Is that what you're saying?
I think that is what I'm saying, actually. I think that's right. Not counting this quarter, when I wrote this quarter hadn't happened, but Microsoft's revenues over the previous four sequential quarters were in the $50 to $53 billion range. Activision's Blizzard's were in the $2 billion range. So Activision Blizzard is by revenue is about 1/25 the size of Microsoft. And the addition of Activision to Microsoft improves Microsoft's revenues by an average of 3.85% per quarter.
So right.
That's how small it is. I mean, again, it's big, but one of the weird issues with Microsoft is that it's huge, right? It's the second biggest.
Really
it's
big.
Huge. Yeah. It's really huge. Yeah. One of the things I tried to do was figure out how big Xbox was. Hmm. And this is kind of interesting because we know like how big PlayStation is.
Mm-hmm.
PlayStation annual revenues of about $27 billion over the past year. We know how big Nintendo is, right? Nintendo over the same time period, roughly $12 billion. Less than half the size of PlayStation, by the way. But we're on the tail end of the Switch wave. Things were different, a couple of years ago, whatever. We know how big more personal computing is, right? I said it was roughly $13 billion a quarter. A quarter, right? So you could add that up to whatever that is in a year. But then we can do this kind of math. Like, remember I said we don't know how big Xbox is as a percentage of that business. If we kind of compare things, console sales and revenues from games and so forth between Sony and Microsoft, and we know that Sony sells roughly 2 to 3 times as many consoles and that the ecosystem is bigger. Is it possible to arrive at kind of a rough idea of how big the Xbox business is? I did some math. I did a lot of guessing. I want to be clear about this, not science. But I came in around $17.75 billion. So I kind of wrote that figure down, and then I went and did some other – I was working on some other stuff for this article. And in the course of research, I came across an article you know, whatever, claiming that Microsoft's overall gaming revenues in 2023, I don't know if that's fiscal or calendar, it doesn't matter, but very recently, was $16.2 billion. So
okay.
They're in the ballpark. But the promise of video games for Microsoft, especially the promise of getting out of its, I'm going to call it a console ghetto in a sense, because the console market is the smallest part of the gaming market, right? PCs just surpassed it again, which is kind of interesting. Mobile games, casual games are over 50%, is those parts of the market in which they don't compete, right? So Microsoft is in PC gaming. I mean, they're not a major player there, but they're there. Mm-hmm. Microsoft will become a major player in mobile gaming, which is kind of interesting. That market is not to Microsoft, but that market overall is worth over $50 billion a year, mobile mm-hmm. gaming. Activision Blizzard earned $556 million in revenues in...
mobile?
Nope, sorry, that's not mobile. That's console. Console and PC for Activision Blizzard are about the same over a year. So about somewhere in the $50 billion range. Is that right?
Million?
No, that's not right. I'm sorry, I'm having trouble reading my own numbers. But the 230, yeah, sorry. Between $38 and $50 billion between console and PC gaming over a year. That seems so high.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's what I have. I want to find the mobile numbers. Sorry, let me find the mobile numbers. So, mobile gaming is the biggest part of Activision business by far. How does that add up? Where am I looking at? Sorry, this must be the overall market. I'm sorry. Overall market is $184 billion. $92 billion is mobile. Activision Blizzard overall is $8.13 billion in revenues. So just 4.4% of the total gaming market, right? Another instance of, yes, big purchase, big company, but tiny part of this giant thing, right?
Well, it's a very fragmented market. I mean, Sony may be the monster here, but they're not that big in mobile.
They're not at all in mobile, basically. Yeah. So here are the real numbers for Activision Blizzard mobile. 43% of their revenues last year, about $943 million. Thank you, Richards. Actually, that's the most recent quarter, came from mobile. So mobile is split up into two main chunks. King Mobile, right, which is Candy Crush, et cetera,
right,
is about 37% of its revenues, plus Call of Duty Mobile, which, by the way, this past year just surpassed $3 billion in revenue over its lifetime, not over a year or a quarter, but over its lifetime. So Call of Duty Mobile has emerged. In fact, I distinctly remember a point in time a year or so ago where Call of Duty kind of surpassed Call of Duty, like the, you know, the console.
Right, the actual game.
Yeah, like, which is really kind of interesting.
It's crazy.
Console gaming, $52 billion in revenues from Activision Blizzard, and then PC gaming was about $38.2 billion. So, you know, if you look at the biggest gaming companies in the world, Microsoft is actually number two behind Sony, but...
By half.
And the thing is, when you add Activision Blizzard to it, I should say number three is Tencent. When you add Activision Blizzard to Microsoft, doesn't change anything. Still number two. A little closer to Sony, a little further away from Tencent. Doesn't change the overall picture there, which is one of those arguments we've been making. So, you know, it's interesting how big this is and yet how small this is.
Yeah.
Right. It's all a matter of what did Obi-Wan say? It's all a point of view or of how you look at it or whatever.
Matter of perception.
Yeah, stupid Obi-Wan. Okay, so there's that. And then also just in the wake of all the big stuff we've been talking about for weeks and weeks, it's interesting to me that the FTC, the head of the FTC, Lena Khan, and the head of the CMA, who's, I can't think of her name right now, I'm sorry, have both come out publicly and spoken about their losses, essentially, right? The CMA hasn't lost, but they're obviously renegotiating, and I think they've done a bizarre job of just looking stupid in the wake of all this stuff. But anyway, both are renegotiating with Microsoft. Both are going to settle with Microsoft. This is going to happen. And if you look at what they've said, the thing you're never going to get from these people is an apology.
Right.
I think the one thing we can say objectively is that neither one of them makes a good argument for stopping this acquisition, and neither one of them thus has any defense after the fact for what they've done.
I would argue they're the largest game studio still standing that's viable, right? I mean,
yep.
Sony is a platform, Microsoft's a platform, Nintendo's a platform.
EA is in there.
What's that? Well, EA's in the same league, and I would argue that's next, right? EA and Epic would kind of be the
Excuse me, God. So yes, actually, I wrote about this. So to your point, I believe you're correct. And it's not so much like I see Sony buying EA, which is what Sony should buy EA. No, I think you're going to see EA and Epic perhaps link up, or there'll be some version of the story where EA starts making acquisitions to make themselves bigger and either more valuable as a huge acquisition target, or more valuable in general, right? This is a, this is the market consolidation.
No,
is a very natural.
EA's not talking to Epic already. I think they're anathema to each other. But they're actually a logical fit because Epic has built a Steam like fairly successfully, something EA has tried repeatedly to do and failed.
Yeah. Epic came out of that same kind of group of companies that was like Apogee and id Software and all that kind of stuff. And those other companies are all part of bigger companies, but Epic is still a standalone thing. And
yeah, they're doing very well. Fortnite, that's their ringer game. And they chose to not just pour it into other games, but to try and pour it into a Steam competitor, into a gaming platform and try and get more games under the umbrella. Yeah. And it's given the perceived value. Like the merger of EA and Epic makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I agree.
I can't see Sony buying anybody that's not Sony style, other than games, true game studios.
Sure.
They contract their game development out to game studios. And I think there's certain points where they realize that studio should be working on stuff alone, and they pull them in.
Right. I mean, Sony is going to buy companies that are either PS exclusive or PS Prime or mostly primary, PS games.
But I would argue they would actually buy ones where they want them to stop making other things. Like,
that's right. That would be part of it. Exactly. Yeah. You know, exactly the opposite of what Microsoft did with Minecraft. So, yeah. You know, Sony. There's definitely going to be consolidation here.
More consolidation. Those two together would be interesting. Mm-hmm. The other studios are great studios. And they, you know, I have nothing bad to say about Ubisoft or Take-Two or any of those guys. They're great. But they're very much the classic studio model.
And they're cross-platform. And it would be too big of a chunk of their revenue where it actually wouldn't make sense to make, which is the argument with Call of Duty, right? To make their best games or any of their games PS exclusives.
Well, but I would also, every one of those studios is working hard to try and make a World of Warcraft, like a continuously monthly revenue game. Like that's always the goal all these companies.
This is, you know, Activision has... Raid and ordered the game industry, by which I mean Raid and Order. That poor bastard spent most of the 1990s trying to fight Microsoft and bought WordPerfect and what's the other side? Whatever the database package was. I'm losing it. Doesn't matter. And then, you know, failed and sold it all off and, you know, whatever. And, you know, Activision came out with Call of Duty and man, everyone tried. And Battlefield, whatever, or, you know, Medal of Honor, which I actually, by the way, preceded Call of Duty, but the original Medal of Honor team went on to make Call of Duty. So the future Medal of Honors were from scratch, whatever, different teams, but no one did it, you know, and it's tough. I mean, it's a tentpole, you know, you get, like you mentioned, Fortnite is that for Battle Royale type games.
Yeah. Not the first, but the winner. You know who's not on the list here? Valve.
No. Right. Is
Valve not on the list? Is there some reason? He's privately held.
I was just going to say, is Valve still a private?
And I have friends who've been in and outside of Valve. They have a substantial, because they're less than 1,000 stockholders in its history. It was always privately funded, and it's been so insanely
came right out of Microsoft, by the way.
The SEC has no jurisdiction there. They grant stock to their employees, and even when those employees leave, they can sell them off. There's an internal market for that stock. But you're talking about a company that revenues in the $15 billion range. Like, they're a player.
I actually don't know. Yeah.
The FCC should have won, because all that's going to happen is this big consolidation now. Everybody said, oh, look, they got away with it. Now it's our turn to merge.
Well, you're like this anti-competitive mole that pops up.
this is what we were talking about.
Yeah, no, I know.
But
this is a natural market.
Condition, oh yeah, if nobody puts a lid on it.
I mean, go back to the early days of the home computers when we had Commodore and Tandy and Atari and Apple and whoever else. You know, at some point, you know, consolidation occurs. In that market was the PC, And it kind of consolidated into the PC to Mac, I guess. I'm not saying it's
tell that to Leonina Khan. At some point, consolidation happens.
Well,
it's not, are you calling it Lisa consolidation? Lisa consolidation.
Lena consolidation.
And we talked about this earlier on. What will actually disrupt the gaming market will be new technology that smaller organizations can hold it faster than the big organizations can. Yep. And that looks like these machine learning models.
The introduction of mobile, I think, did it. That really shifted the dynamic. And by the way, of course, it did. It's the biggest part of the gaming market. So
it's the biggest platform.
Before there was an iPhone. It was consoles. Well, it was probably it was consoles and PCs and web, casual stuff. It shook up the market. It took control of the market, right? Yeah. It's literally the biggest part of the gaming market.
Well, in terms of seats, the revenues in it, the net profitability of that stuff is challenging. But we get into, again, I think these tech giants are going to have a tough time. With these parasitic revenue models.
We talked about this possibility. We literally up front in the show, this notion that maybe AI could make it possible for individuals or small teams to create sophisticated games, right?
Yeah.
The one for all the problems with the app stores, and there are many problems, and some of them are caused just by popularity. There are too many games. It's still possible for an individual to create a game that could be seen by people on actual mobile devices in a way that is not possible on consoles. And PCs, because unless it's like a little indie game that's kind of a cute scroller thing or whatever, but it is. I'm just a huge fan of that kind of democratization effect. Mm-hmm.
Every time you have a shift in platform, that's interesting, right?
Yeah,
and certainly mobile with cloud has opened the door to. And I think when I think about Rick, really serious, like could not play any other way. Mm-hmm. It's Pokemon Go. Right.
Well, yes.
GPS bound, so location matters.
Did you see that the new Pokemon Go came out? It's Pokemon Sleep. There's another way to. This sounds like a joke, doesn't it?
Yeah. What is it? I don't even know.
You play it in bed. No. It's real. Pokemon Sleep. You play it in bed. It's a sleep monitor. And you got to catch them all. I'm not making this up.
I don't understand. Is it like Freddy Krueger? It's invaded our dreams. I don't understand.
You don't believe me, so I'm going to show you.
Is it?
No, April 1st? I believe you.
I think I'm making this up. I know you do, but I'm not. See, Pokemon Sleep. It's and you get Pokemon by sleeping.
I know. I mean,
so I'm just saying, like innovation is not dead. I'm just saying.
But I feel like maybe this is offensive to people who have sleep apnea. What are we talking about? I don't understand.
I don't get it either. But the whole thing of Pokemon Go is to get people out walking. Now it's to get them.
This is Pokemon
sleeping.
No Go.
It's from the same. It's from Niantic, I think. It's the same people.
Yeah, so it's probably a response to people saying my kids are staying up all night because they're still trying to catch Pokemon.
Oh, maybe. Yeah.
Oh boy.
We'll make one to make them go to bed.
Yeah. actually, it's not Niantic.
Create something else.
It's the Pokemon Company. So they partnered with Niantic to make Pokemon Go. Now they're going on their own, and they said, "What would even be more dynamic than Pokemon Go? Pokemon Sleep."
Yeah. Huh.
That's my app of the week. You can't lose.
I mean, you can't lose if you don't play.
There you go.
I mean,
all right. Okay. That's innovation in a nutshell.
It's something. I don't know. Yeah. I guess it's innovation. Yeah. All right.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to derail the conversation.
Honestly, that was more interesting than what I was talking about. So I just, a minor point, with all the topsy-turvy stuff happening behind the scenes at the Microsoft, Activision, Blizzard stuff, it's very confusing. We don't understand how these regulatory bodies work.
I don't know that they understand how they work.
Yeah, I don't. So the CMA, there was a bunch of legal machinations last week where they basically put a halt to all of their actions, potential actions, and thus their deadlines against Microsoft so they could negotiate. The FTC essentially did the same thing this past week, bowing to the inevitable.
You're losing.
Different process, but same net effect. So nothing major to report, but both of these things are positive developments in the sense that, well, not to Leo, but they're positive.
not to me, my friend.
Sorry, let me rephrase. They are, I think, indicative of the fact that this acquisition is going to go through.
Yeah.
Whatever your take on that is. So, okay. Xbox, actual Xbox. Couple
of
little
things.
You know
what? It's funny thing about Pokemon Sleep. Mm-hmm. I'm just setting it up right now. And one of the things, they won't let you go on unless you read the terms of use.
You actually have to read them.
You want to see how long the terms of use
are? I bet it's pages. Well,
maybe that's the whole game. Like,
this is how you get sleep.
You got it.
Like this in Japanese.
You got to read them.
How did they find a 2-point font that was that unreadable?
And now I have to read the privacy notice before I can agree to it. Wonder how long that is. Oh, boy. Do they really think people are going to read this? It is literally 2-point font.
Yeah. And pages and pages.
Now
pages.
I'm sleeping. So
that's the sleep part.
That's the sleep right there. Oh, I mean, they're making you lie, basically, before you could play this game. You have
that's
to lie.
Amazing.
You have to say, I read this.
Yeah.
That's one of two. I don't know how many pages
it's
there.
Still going.
Now it's in Chinese.
Okay,
great. Excellent. It's multiple languages. It's every language, I guess, even though I told it my language was English. So now I can do it. You save data, including your tracked sleep sessions, will be saved to our server. I agree to this use of data.
Where is this data about your sleep going? Is this China? Is China taking this?
It's, yeah.
This feels like China.
We got to call Troy Hunt.
But I read all, but you know, we won't let you unless you read the, okay, now I'm sleeping.
I'm sleeping.
It's not a very active game.
All right, do nothing. You win. You did the least.
Oh, wait a minute. Well now done. A 531 megabyte update will be downloaded.
It's like an Xbox game.
To sleep, you need a lot of data.
A lot of data for sleeping.
All right, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
Just what a world we live in.
What a world. At least you're trying to promote good, healthy sleep.
You know what would really top this off is is an Xbox segment. Really make this go.
So if you've been listening or watching to this podcast for a long time, you'll remember the horrible era of the Xbox One, where Microsoft just couldn't make a dashboard that was performant. They just couldn't do it. It ran some of the most sophisticated 3D games imaginable at the time, but navigating around this UI was horrible. And again and again and again, they tried. They tried everything. They talked about how this was going to fix this and that. And everyone complained. It was never fast enough. And so finally, they gave up. And at the end of this cycle, they said, all right, this is what we're going to do. They didn't say it this way. I'm paraphrasing because, you know, I can see between the lines what happened there. But like, we're just going to eliminate steps. The way we're going to make this thing work faster is you don't have to click on as many things. And so they just started making it more efficient. And then the Xbox One, the Xbox Series X and S arrived. And with the same dashboard, which is like interesting, and we've been having the same problems. It doesn't get as much press these days, but again and again and again, Microsoft will experiment with or release a new version of what they call the home experience, the dashboard. And everyone's like, this thing's too slow. It doesn't work, blah, blah, blah. So that happened this year. They released something. Everyone hated it. They said it was too compact. Again, they were trying to get as much on screen as possible so you didn't have to start scrolling and everything because that would betray the horrible performance of it. And so they backed off from that. They fixed that. They put some white space back in. And now today they have started rolling out a new dashboard. And it's supposed to be faster. But we have reached that point that I described. They're literally, the way they're optimizing this is they're looking at ways they can reduce steps to get you from... I don't know, turning it on to playing the game you want to play. To me, this seems like an easy task. Yeah. You know,
we don't need to make it fast. We just make sure you don't have to use it for very long.
Yep. So anyway, that's happening. You can be excited or not about that. I'm losing my mind. most people, although we've discussed it from time to time, have probably never heard of something called Google Play Games for PC. Google announced this in late 2021, I think. Right around the time that Microsoft started talking about the Android app system, the Windows subsystem for Android, right? So one of the key parts of that original announcement, just in case you thought these two guys were working together, we are not using Microsoft's technology. Uh-huh. This has nothing to do with this. So in the beginning, we weren't really clear on what this was. Was it like an emulator? It was like a game streaming service, maybe based on Stadia. But by the time they released the first kind of early beta, it was only in certain countries at the time. It eventually expanded to many more, including now the United States. What we know now is that it is its own emulation layer. The idea being that they'll curate games from the full Play Store, bring them down to run on PC. Because, you know, they want you to be able to use the keyboard if it makes sense or a gamepad or whatever. You know, they want it, you know, not everyone has a touch screen PC or whatever. So, you know, they're doing kind of what Amazon does a little bit with their App Store, what Microsoft has done a little bit actually with Game Pass titles that are streamed right over to mobile devices using cloud streaming or cloud gaming. And we kind of land today and here we are. So now this thing, which is a month, you know, still in beta 2 years later, is available in over 120 different regions around the world, right? That just doubled. It's accessible to more people because they've lowered the minimum system requirements for the PC you need to run this thing, which opened it up to hundreds of millions of additional computers. Granted, some of them, you know, the experience could be bad depending on the type of game you're playing. And there are hundreds of games. I don't know how many. I don't like counting games. I don't like when people do this to me. But this is where the disconnect happens for me because I don't know any of these games. Like, this is a different world. I actually feel like a lot of these, like, you know, that there are different markets for games. Like in Japan, for example, there's a whole world of games that we only see a little chunk of here in the United States, and they're very different from the stuff we're used to. It looks like that kind of stuff for me. I mean, there are games in there that, you know, everyone's heard of course, but they list things like Free Fire Max, Cookie Run Kingdom, Eversoul, Summoner's War, Homescapes, Ebony, The King's Return, Call of Dragons, and Ark Knights. Okay. I mean, I realize I'm an old guy now, but seriously, I don't know what any of this stuff is. So
are any of these games good? I guess is the question.
I don't know. Yeah. So it's out there. You can check it out. If you have a Windows PC, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what to tell you, but it's a thing. So yeah. there you go. And this is interesting only because it's Blizzard, right? So Blizzard is part of Activision Blizzard. And if you are familiar with the kind of business models that are happening here, Microsoft, which is about to acquire this company, is trying to push a model in which games, although we'll see strategy-wise, you know, which games, right, can appear day and date when they're released to purchase through Xbox Game Pass subscriptions, right? Xbox Cloud Gaming, which is the streaming service. So imagine Call of Duty new version comes out. The acquisition has come out. Does Microsoft put Call of Duty on Game Pass? Do they let you stream it over the cloud, right? If they do, will not something bad happen revenue-wise, right? Because Call of Duty every year is a blockbuster. I don't know how they're going to handle this. But Activision, in their own world, one of the things that they did over time was move to a situation where they basically self-distribute, right? They distribute all their own games.
On Battle.net.
Yeah, right. They're starting to step back from that, possibly because of the Microsoft thing, right? You know, Microsoft's going to do some different stuff. So Blizzard, which is part of Activision Blizzard, obviously, is now bringing some of their key titles to Steam, which is one of the biggest and probably the biggest distribution point on PC. I guess maybe the web is probably technically the biggest, but whatever. As far as these services that, you know, have game stores and yada, 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 it must be the biggest. So yeah, it's like, so we did Battle.net and now we're doing different stuff. And I think, you know, this is maybe a little preview of the Microsoft effect, as I'll call it. Actually, we should call it the Phil Spencer effect, where this company's games will be more broadly available than was the strategy of this company when it was a standalone company, right? Activision famously very much against Game Pass. So,
well, we'll see. Not anymore. Welcome to the club. You're in the club now.
That's right. Yeah, so we'll see. I'm very curious. I mean, if Activision's catalog games, as I call them, are what constitutes Game Pass, I think that's fine. I think having legacy, like meaning 1 year old or older games on Game Pass,
on Steam, but I think part of this is, have they made a deal so that it's still downloading from their servers? Like they still collect all the same data. It's just a different user interface over the top, effectively.
Yeah, I don't know. I have no idea how
Steam. I'm very much in the place where it's like I seriously resist buying a game that isn't on Steam because Steam is where I look for my games.
Me too.
Yeah.
Me too. That's who owns me.
Yeah. The nice thing about the PC though is you can pick and choose, you know? So if a game isn't on Steam, you don't lose anything by buying it from Epic or just the web, you know, Amazon.
No, you have to go look at the Epic launcher to get to it.
And that's why you should all be using the Xbox app on Windows. I'm glad. Thank you for allowing me to do this advertisement. It aggregates your games from all the different stores. Nobody uses it, but it is a feature.
Ironically, the Steam app really is horrible. I mean, it updates all the time. It's big. Yeah. It loads in the background unless you explicitly tell it not to.
Yeah.
But it's convenient.
And the only thing worse than the Steam library tool is everybody else's implementation of it, right? It is the reference version that that Epic and Battle.net and all those guys try and copy, and theirs are worse.
Yeah,
the only thing worse than any of those is everything EA has ever made.
It's a copy of a copy. This is the quick burger story. It's like we saw this terrible thing and we duplicated it, but we forgot some stuff, so it's even worse.
Yeah, it's like you're on your fifth reordered photocopy, and boy, it's just a blur now.
Yep.
Okay. All right. That was our double Xbox segment because two is better than one.
So XE. Now with extra X.
Extra X. Just to upset Elon. Sorry, buddy.
The more I think about it, the more I realize X is the least searchable, the least trademarkable name you could possibly come up with.
Yeah.
It's totally generic.
.net runs in that category pretty well, too.
Yeah, that's
true.
It's
too bad he could have used a lowercase I in front of the name and just changed it to iTwitter.
Ix.
That would have been better.
iTwitter.
Yeah.
All right. Little break, a little breath, the pause that refreshes. Then it's the back of the book coming up next. To the back of the book we go with Paul Thurrott's tip of the week. I want to hear you say this out loud.
I know. I know you do. I'm going to try to disappoint you.
Oh, come on. Say it.
Clip gems, hidden gems. So,
what he's trying to say, is Clip Champ's hidden gems.
I'm turning into Clip Champ's biggest fan, and I'm not comfortable with it.
I'm impressed by it too, man. It's a really great app.
This is the video editing app that Microsoft acquired and now builds into Windows.
By the way, it's a web app. Okay. So here's the thing. Back in January or something, I wrote an article about it. And to figure out how good it was, I tried to emulate one of the videos I make for our YouTube channel, and it could do everything that I was doing in Adobe Premiere. So I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting. It does, you know, doesn't literally do everything, but I mean, seriously, it does way more than you might think.
Are you saying it's better than Windows Movie Maker?
So it's been for the day, it's in the same ballpark. It's in the same.
It's the same idea, right?
It's a surprisingly powerful and full-featured application.
Nice.
So I think I discussed this. I think I had this as the app pick a few weeks ago, because since we came here, there's something about Adobe Premiere and certain hardware. It won't render without glitching stuff all over the place. And none of the PCs I have here could render video, which I had spent hours making in Premiere. And I'm like, I don't want to waste time learning another, but I'm like, okay, here we go. So I knew the two contenders were going to be the baby toy Clip Champ and then something like DaVinci Resolve. And I'm like, I'm going to learn this thing. Screw it. And man, if you thought Adobe Premiere was tough, welcome to the cockpit of a 747. DaVinci Resolve is horrific.
It's a lot.
And I was getting there, but I was like, man, this trip's going to be over. I need to make a video. I just want to get, this is not my job. I don't care. I just want to get this done. So I picked up Clip Champ and my God, this thing worked great. So coincidentally to this, I'm trying to get the Windows 11 field guide fine. Not fine. It's never going to be done, but the content complete, every chapter is in the book, et cetera. So one of the missing chapters from the digital media section was Clip Champ. So I'm like, you know what? I just spent a bunch of time learning this thing, and actually didn't need a lot of time. I spent a lot of time using it and then discovering some of its ins and outs. And so I decided I would write the chapter, which I did. So 50 pages long. It's a big chapter. It's the biggest. It might be the biggest chapter in the book because there's a lot going on, and I had to leave some stuff out. There's just a lot of stuff in there. So I just wanted to discuss two of the things that I think are kind of unusual and almost AI and are not the top level features that anyone would talk about when it comes to this product or this kind of product, right? So for example, one of the things you can do with this feature, this app, is record yourself with a camera, obviously. You can record the screen, like do a screen recording, like if you're going to demonstrate software. You can have a combination of those things with different views, screen and camera, right? That's not a big deal. Actually, I'm sorry. That is a big deal, but it's not unusual, right? We see that we have tools for those things. This thing has a text-to-speech feature, with multiple AI-based voices that sound incredible.
That's nice.
And if you don't want to narrate your own video, perhaps, or I'm sure there's other uses, you can instead write like I do, push the writing into this, and then generate an audio file that sounds like a human being talking.
Wow.
It is amazing. It is amazing.
You know, this is what the reason this is better and different than Movie Maker is that we're in the TikTok era, and these are all TikTok yes. features, basically, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. All right. Fair enough. Yep.
And so very much TikTok interface, it sounds like.
Yeah. I would argue as a 50-something-year-old that this usage spans the TikTok generation to me, and that there are uses on my side of the fence as well, right? Like the one I just used. But yes, fair enough. That's you can, of course, create 9x16 videos and do all that stuff if you want to make like phone videos, but I don't. I'm an adult. All right. So one of the other ones is captions. So they have this notion, which is semi-related when you think about it, but kind of
goes both ways. Yeah.
It goes both ways. So they have these effects and things you can add to videos like everyone else, right? So you can do audio fades and video fades. You can do all kinds of filters and effects, adjust colors, adjust the speed, the playback speed, transitions, color, et cetera. But one thing that applies globally, it doesn't matter. This does not apply to a clip in the timeline. It applies to the entire video that you're making, is you can turn on auto captions. So I actually don't have it on in this computer, which is stupid, but I will turn it on here. You can actually filter for profanity and offensive language. But when you turn this thing on, it generates captions for your video, which you can edit as you're going through the edit process. So if it mishears you or whatever, I took one of the videos that Stephanie and I made and I did an auto caption for it, and I corrected three things in the entire video.
Wow.
And it creates an SRT file. You can embed them directly in the video. You can do whatever you want. This is a really neat feature. And for this to work in a product that, by the way, is free and, by the way, is a web app, I want to emphasize this, to me is incredible. This app is more powerful than it needs to be, frankly, for something that's a bundle, you know, a free tie-in or whatever. It's a free thing you get with Windows. You can pay for it. When you pay for it, you get cloud storage through them. You get additional stock music, sound effects, and video. Music, sound effects, and videos, and images. If I missed one. But I don't need that stuff, right? So I don't. Some people might. It's reasonable now if you do want that. I think it's under 10 bucks a month. It's $7 or $8 a month, whatever it is. But I didn't even look at that stuff. I'm just looking at the free stuff. Like, I'm sorry, but this kind of functionality in a free web-based tool, like, are you kidding me? Wow. You should look at this app. I know the name is funny. We make fun of it. It's hard not to. We are bullies. I don't know why we do this, but we do. But the more I look at this, the more I use it, and I've been using it nonstop now for the entire month.
Well, and in the context of TikTok, Clipchop is a great name.
Clipchamp.
Clipchamp.
Yeah. Clipchop would be good.
I'm turning into a clip chump.
How about clip plop?
Yeah. Yeah, Clipchamp is a good name in TikTok here.
Listen, the Pentium name sounded stupid the first time we heard it. All I'm saying is this app is fantastic.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's fantastic.
Paulie.
Yep.
Paulie, you found your new friend.
He's
a believer.
I will be, I think next week, as soon as next week, probably next Thursday, I'll be recording new episodes of Hands on Windows.
Good.
And one of the first ones I will do will be a big clip. And it will probably
do
be
a whole series. Do a whole series.
Yeah, that's interesting. Maybe I will.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Maybe a month worth of Clip Champ. That's fantastic. I love it.
Really good.
I love it.
Okay. I knew I was going to get a pushback on that, but it's good.
No, I'm not giving you pushback.
I'm supporting you.
I think this is a wonderful idea.
No, I meant just mentioning Clipchamp. All right.
Oh, that, yeah.
Anywho.
yeah. What are you, girl?
I don't know. What the hell are you thinking?
What are you thinking?
What do you wear? A dress when you use it?
What are you, Barbie?
Yeah. So
you wear pink? I'm sorry. I was the patriarchy, Tarkin. Just ignore it.
I don't get it.
Just ignore it. How about an app pick of the week, even though that really
so if
was.
If you use Windows, and you do, you're here, right?
Yeah.
Windows has a feature called Nearby Sharing that allows you to, over Bluetooth or hopefully Wi-Fi, share files from one computer to the other. I just mentioned the book writing process. One of the things I do is I use a certain computer that I have actually one here and at home, right, for this purpose, for screenshots, same exact computer. And when I'm done, I go through the chat, you know, the writing computer, and when I have them all, I use Nearby Sharing to wirelessly transmit them to the computer I'm using for writing and editing, where I will edit those things, rename them, put them in the right folder. get them into the book. On Apple, they have something called, who cares what they have, but Apple has something obviously that
who cares?
Yeah, if you have iPhones and iPads and Macs, you can move files back and forth, right?
It's continuity. Yeah.
Kind of, thanks. I didn't care. But now, thank you. I childhood memory is now gone because that, okay. So that's fine.
Lost forever.
So Google's ecosystem, they have a nearby share feature, which works between Android devices and Chromebooks, of course. But now they have an app for Windows that brings it to Windows, which makes sense because, you know, Windows, a lot of Android users use Windows. So they released this as a beta back in April, and now it is generally available and everyone can get it. They made a couple of improvements. You know, the file transfer estimates are more accurate. You get image previews if that's what you're transferring. The performance is better, et cetera, et cetera. I hate having to install an extra app. I wish to God that they had figured out a way. This is probably Microsoft's fault, but it would have been really neat if they could have just integrated this with nearby sharing in Windows and just had it be like a integrated feature. But I get, you know, whatever, all kinds of reasons why they didn't do that. But if you have a need to transfer files between your Android phone and Windows, this is available. It works well. I will say the most common time I need to do this is with photos. But what happens is I'll take pictures of a device, like I'm going to write a review, right? I put the phone down. I go to my computer. I go to photos.google.com. They're already there. They've already synced up. I select the ones I need. I download them. That works for me.
Yeah, that's what I usually do.
Yeah. So that's my most common use case. So I don't really need this a lot. I can't say I've done performance benchmarking, but my internet connection speeds here.
I've also been, you know, I'm busy collecting photos around the house for the handbook for somebody else to own my house.
Same thing. Yep.
And the big thing for me with Nearby Share is that as I'm taking the photos, I'm telling it, send this to my laptop.
Oh, that's cool.
Send this to the computer. Oh, by the time I get back there, really it's already there. I don't have that extra step.
Yeah, there you go. That's
so you don't have to do it all at once. You can just say, send everything back.
Yeah,
just keep sending stuff back. That's a nice feature, I think. I like that. It's like tethering. That's what they call it in the professional photography studios. Tethering.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. That being said, I often take, you know, several photos before I get a good one. And so it's useful to call.
You're also transferring things that are garbage, but
that's okay. That's what transferring is for. You don't pay for it.
Exactly. Yeah. I didn't get this bandwidth not to use it, put garbage on it. Who cares?
Especially bandwidth within my network.
Saturated.
I spent all this time building a perfect structured Wi-Fi environment here. By golly, I'm going to try and fill it
up. Right. I always use this for everything, but like my favorite example of this is like we were in Mexico City last year and my son's like, why are the cops are all blowing whistles? Like they're all over the place. He's like, they're not even doing anything. Like, what are they blowing their whistles for? I'm like, Mark, they didn't give them whistles not to use them. You know?
Duh. If you had a whistle, you'd blow it. Yeah.
We're giving you this whistle. Use it.
Use it.
Yeah. And do they use it?
Yeah.
It's a thing.
Latin America, it's all about the street sounds.
Noise.
It's noise. All
about the
noise.
And noise. Friday afternoon riots.
Yep. Or parades.
They call them protests.
The difference between the parade and the riot is just the
amount. I always wish, like, you know, you guys know, like Rick Steves, that guy who does Europe. I always wish Rick Steves would cover Mexico because I like walk around and just imitate him all the time. I'm like, the citizens of Mexico City are exercising their democratic right to protest. You know, like it's like
I actually like,
they got a thing.
I do the same thing. Like I want to be Rick Steves when I grow up. When I'm walking around, I do the same thing.
I do. I walk. I'm like, Boston is a cultural bully event.
Turn on your Rick Steves and go.
Yep.
I think we should get a run as radio pick for this particular show here.
Episode 890. This is one of the shows I recorded while at Build back a few months ago now. And this show is with Microsoft VP Bob Sir. Bob's an unusual VP in the sense that didn't grow within. He was hired out of Amazon. He worked on the Alexa skills kit for a long time. So always involved with audio and audio interfaces and things like that. So he got pulled over into ACS or Azure Communication Services. This is sort of the overall ownership for voice, video, text, the underlying library that drove Skype that now drives Teams. And he's ultimately responsible for the initiative to bring those capabilities into any piece of software. So they're building a lot. They have library tools and so forth. And our conversation was really driven on this idea of not having to shift context, that you're working on a particular problem and you need help, or you want to ask questions, and being able to do it from within the app rather than having to go to a Slack or a Teams or your chat app du jour, or making a separate call just at where you are, and then also having access to that app. So not so much share the screen effect, but a literally like share the particular chunk of data that matters. It was a really fun conversation. He's a smart guy, you know, clearly been working in his space and has a broad viewpoint on it, having worked with different in different environments around it. Of course, we had to talk. We were built, so there was a couple of large language model conversations in there. You know, Runaz is very sysadmin focused, so pretty quickly I was on the, hey, this is my tier one tech support. Like anything that reduces the number of tickets coming in to help is help desk is a good thing. I would, as a sysadmin, want to encourage this kind of direction because it's going to save me tickets in the long run.
Runaz Radio, 890. You have, for some reason, four brown liquors.
Well, I'm really, a while ago, I thought I would talk about bottles.
Ah.
And I finally finished the writing on the bottle story. And that's why I listed a few different whiskeys.
So this isn't about what's in them. This is about the bottles that holds the whiskey.
Well, and we've talked a bunch of times, both in the, you know, Irish story and Scottish story and so forth, about buying barrels, right?
Right.
And when did bottling just become the mainstream thing? Because later there were laws passed that said you have to sell your booze in bottles as opposed to barrels. And you know, why did that change? So, I mean, glass bottles have been around for a long time. Archaeologists have found evidence of bottle glass blowing in Mesopotamia from 1500 BC. So you're talking 3,000 plus years of bottle making. It's only when you jump forward to like the 1600s where glass starts to get cheaper through industrialization, coal-fired plants and so forth. But glass used to be a relatively precious thing, and a glass bottle was a big deal, which really, you know, speaks to the whole decanter model. Like, have you ever always thought, like, the whiskey decanter is sort of a classic thing, right? The decanter bottle with its matching set of glasses. And yet, today, like, why would you take the whiskey out of the bottle, put it in the decanter? It's not like it needs to breathe. But that's not how whiskey was sold for the longest time. It was only available in barrels. And so because glass was so expensive and precious, you would own a decanter, and you would, or your servant would, take the decanter down to the chemist where, you know, I don't know what kind of 19th century Robert Barron you are. Like
we do this with kombucha, but...
So you would own a barrel. You would rather go get your decanter filled by the barrel at the barrel.
Oh, that's interesting. So whiskey was sold by the barrel. That's why you needed a decanter.
Right. Because then that's what you'd have at your bar or at your service.
Right. So
you didn't want to have the barrel around. And this is because glass making is not a trivial process. It's hard to do. Right. And it's been fun. You've seen this, the hand blowing of glass and how they make bottles and so forth. And it actually explains a lot of the odd things about bottles. If you think about how weird bottles actually are, you know, that they use these long metal tubes and they pick up bits of melted silica from a kiln. And that's really the challenge of all of this, is how you get enough heat to make glass reliably. 1500 degrees Celsius, like 2500 or 2400 Fahrenheit, is what you need to really make enough heat to make glass well. And that's just not easy to do without a lot of technology. The terminology, because it's been around for hundreds of years, is hilarious. They use terms like the marver, which is this piece of metal or a piece of marble that you flatten the glass on while it's still partly molten. That when you pick up the glass out of the furnace, it's called a gather. But the moment you actually put it on the marver and put a little air into it, so it's got a little air bubble in it, well, now it's a parazon. So now,
Richard, you're turning into a glass nerd, and I got to say,
you got to see these websites, man. Like, there are people who are crazy about handmade bottles. Like, it's a big thing, right?
I kind of understand that. I mean,
and it's really
if you go to Venice and take the boat out to Murano and watch them make the Murano glass.
I only use handmade Dungeons and Dragons dice. I know what you mean.
Yeah, but the question I wanted, I mean, the general shape of a bottle makes sense, right? It's got enough room for the liquid. It's got a small neck on it to minimize air contact. That was largely for wine, not as important for whiskey. But it was the punt that bugged me. Why is the bottom of the bottle got a dent in it? Like, what is that all about? And there's lots of stupid reasons why people think that a punt exists.
That way it looks like it's bigger than it really is. It's like the hole on a bowling ball so you can hold it.
Or it's a place to put the thumb to pour it, not that anybody actually pours it that way. So here's the real reason there's a punt. When you're blowing a glass bottle, so you've sort of got it to shape now, the blow rod is down the throat of the bottle, obviously, and you've been shaping the bottom to some degree, you need to make the neck and the end point of the bottle. You got to get that rod out of there. And the bottle's too hot to handle. Mm. So an assistant now will take what's called a pontil rod and pick up a little glass from the furnace and will stick it to the bottom of the bottle to hold it for you while you complete the neck. So now you're using a pair of tongs on what they call a chair, and you sort of shape it, and you actually use a little bit of water with these tongs to make that part brittle, and you snap it off, and now the pontil rod is actually holding the bottle. And then as the bottle cools sufficiently, they can snap the pontil off, and that'll leave a little mark on the bottom of the bottle. And so they push that pontil in, shortened to punt, so that it doesn't leave a sharp point on the bottom of the bottle.
Like the fontanelle on a skull? kind of a thing.
Soft spot. So it started to be a little bit of an indent, and it's just a place to leave the pontil mark behind on. And that's not a big deal. It's a logical thing for them to do. And then it just became the style after that. I'd also point out that, especially with hand-blown glass, making a flat bottom is almost impossible. And you want the bottle to not be tippy or slippy. And so they actually will push the punt in to make a rim around the bottom of the bottle, and then they'll roll that rim against a mark to make it sort of bumpy and serrated so it has a little traction when it's sitting. It's much more stable to sit on a ring than it is to sit on a flat surface with a bit of traction on it. So the bottom of the bottle makes sense. Punts were just created to make bottoms work better, and all those other explanations are wacky excuses. Hand-blown bottles are just not practical. It takes a long time. It takes a lot of people. It was often used a ton of child labor just because, that was part of the model. Mold-formed bottles became popular in the late 18th, early 19th century. So by the 1870s or so, we're mostly forming with molds. And so same blowing process, you're still making a parazon, which is a blob of molten glass with a bit of an air pocket in it. But then a kid is opening up a mold sitting on the ground. You stick the parazon in it. It slams shut and locked. And then they blow hard to basically slam the glass up against the inside of the mold to the point where, and I've seen video of this, there's literally like a bubble of glass that forms at the top as the blowpipe breaks away. Let it cool for 30 seconds. It's enough to take it out. And this is where you get all of those sort of classic bottles that have embedded letters and things on them or textures on them, because they can put that into the mold. Huh. And it substantially improves the speed of making bottles. Hmm. And once you've made a bottle, by the way, it's quite fragile. Bottles break all of the time because they're under a lot of tension when they've been molded quickly like that. The normal cooling process for a blown bottle is about 2 days. You literally put it in a kiln with declining temperatures, or it's very likely to shatter, and it releases the tension. It's called annealing. It sort of re-eases the bottle. Today, modern bottles are mostly silica sand. They use a mixture of soda ash and limestone. So these are all pretty common chemicals, silicon dioxides, sodium carbonates, and calcium carbonates. Glass is recycled because the glass making process breaks so much glass. They got pretty good at recycling. It's called cullet. But there's a big reason that glass continues to be recycled heavily. It takes less energy to remelt existing glass than it is to melt it from silica. So it's actually energy efficient to keep recycling glass. Color glass is made with particular chemicals. The classic green glass, you use chromium dioxides. there are often contaminants that color glass. Getting clear glass was really hard. But the real transformation of glass comes in 1903 from America. A fellow by the name of Michael Owens, who had been working on Edison making light bulbs at scale, moved over to a bottle making company and finally built a machine that took the manual blowing step out. So he's still using molds, but the actual parazon was now made mechanically. So there was a big kiln. They would actually pour the liquid silicate from that, separated into sections that were roughly parazon side, and it would land into the mold, and then a mechanical blower would hit it, blow it out, and it would rotate. Then they moved down an assembly line, and the assembly line literally has flames coming out of it, so it's good hell looking stuff. But they're trying to keep the glass warm enough that it won't shatter until it can get to the annealing furnace. Wow. And so they went from a team able to make 3,000 to 5,000 bottles a day to a machine that could do 50,000 bottles a day. Wow. And that's what drove the price of bottling down, was suddenly it's over. Like, that is so much cheaper to make bottles that way that we just use bottles for everything.
Huh. That's fascinating.
And so, as is consistent with the stories that I tell on this show about whiskey, I then immediately go to the exceptions, because the vast majority of whiskey, like 99.99% of our industrial made bottles, they use molds. You can see the seams on them. They have a little edge on them and so forth. That's just the nature of the way you make glass. Are there still hand blown glass bottles for whiskey? And yes, there is. The problem is that it's the most exotic whiskey you can possibly imagine. And that's largely what I've listed here. Things like the Chivas Royal Salute 62 Gun Salute, which is a whiskey blend made by the Chivas Company. The youngest thing in the bottle is 40 years old.
That is this good whiskey? Because it is a beautiful bottle.
Apparently it is. I've never tried it. It's a hand-blown bottle with a crystal stopper.
I have my own crystal stoppers, but that's fine.
When it was,
the thing is, you can use this as a decanter after it's done. These are beautiful bottles.
Why would
bottles?
You throw these bottles away? Yeah. They're gorgeous, yeah. Right? And so when it was first released, $2,200 US a bottle.
Yikes.
I've found a bottle on one of the whiskey exchange sites for $4,500.
Jeez.
That's the cheapest of this list until we get to something practical. So next up, the Glenfiddich 50. This one I have had. I had a taste of it. So this is, again, a hand-blown green glass bottle. This is a straight Fiddich 50, so it's a space side. Trimmed in silver. The box is embossed leather.
Is that actual silver? Silver?
Actual silver, because it's a $30,000 bottle.
Yeah, jeez.
Where did you taste this? Who had this to taste?
This was at the Glenlivet Distillery when I was doing a tour. And the ultimate manifestation of absurdity in glass blown would be Macallan's Lily Collection. Macallan's notorious for doing the most ridiculous, incredible, insane things. Lalique is one of the best crystal makers in the entire world. And so the crystal collection is 6 different types of bottles they've released over time. If you can get a look at the different bottles, they are unbelievably gorgeous. They are the youngest version of this is a 50. They have a 55. There is a 72, which is exactly one of in the world. If you could find one, and you cannot, starting at $500,000.
Wow.
What the what? Just
look at the bottle. The bottle is beautiful, right? Like, it's so silly.
It's funny.
So this is just one of them.
You got to go to the collection page.
I'll go back a page. There we go. Yeah,
there's your collection page. So there's the 50. My. This is Lily Crystal. So, I mean, they're just...
It's so when you say that, I hear the term Little League... What is
La Lique?
It's a French crystal maker. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. Very famous.
I'm surprised I didn't know that.
I only list these to just show this is typically where you find hand blown glass. And now I'm going to tell one that isn't hand blown glass, but is when I think about a beautiful bottle.
I love this bottle. Yeah.
Lanterns. It's one of the prettiest bottles in the business.
Yeah. People collect them. You get that. They give you like a, but you can go to Blanton's and they'll give you a strip from the barrel.
Yeah,
and then there are holes for each of the stoppers.
Oh, I didn't realize they're different horses in each of the stoppers.
Then they spell Blanton's, and there are two different ends, because there's two ends in Blanton's, so make sure you get both ends.
Two ends of the horse?
There's lots of people who talk about how the one is much harder to get than the other. It's not true. They're made in equal quantities. In fact, if you just want all eight stoppers, Blanton's will sell them to you for $80. So not a big deal.
Oh, but I have to see which one I have. I didn't even know they were different.
Yeah, it's a fun thing to do.
That's cute.
So let me tell you, the stories of Blanton's is the story of Buffalo Trace. So the Buffalo Trace Distillery in Frankfurt is this massive distillery. It makes lots of different kinds of whiskey. Many you've heard of. E.H. Taylor, Eagle Rare, they're all in there. Okay. Yep. And so the supposed story of Blanton's is that the president of Buffalo Trace from the 20s through to the 50s, which is a guy named Albert Bacon Blanton, because everybody needs the middle name Bacon. That's a good one.
Bacon's good.
The main warehouse at Buffalo Trace, which they call Warehouse H, is an all metal wreck house. This is very unusual, right? That the metal walls, metal roof, dirt floors and wooden racks, and this is where they aged their Buffalo Trace, typically 5 to 6 years long, and that Blanton got in the habit of pulling prime barrels for his friends that he would find. He called them center barrels, so barrels that had the optimal aging experience, because you have to think, like, Kentucky's quite a bit warmer than northern Scotland especially, and so in a metal rick house, it's quite stressful. It gets very hot in the summertime. It gets very cold in the wintertime. Relatively speaking, it's Kentucky. And so the barrels go through a lot. And so centered barrels that were a little more cushioned from the extremes had a better aging experience. And he'd keep them a little longer, sometimes 7-8 years. And then he would do a bottling from that barrel. That's the origin of Blanton's, is from the guy named Blanton doing this private barreling. And they eventually made into product. It's one of the reasons that Blanton's is so bloody hard to find right now, is they are all single barrels. They take a single barrel, they essentially bottle it as is. The ABV is going to vary, and they generally have an addition number on it. The actual style of bourbon, because Buffalo Trace makes a huge array of different bourbons, they have a set of mash bills that they call them the three mash bills. They're all kept secret. But the mash bill one is, you know, typical mash bill in bourbon is corn, rye, barley, right? And so the real variation is how much rye. And so the mash bill one is a low rye mash bill, believed to be less than 10% rye. And so that's your Buffalo Trace, your Eagle Rares, your E.H. Taylors all come from mash bill one. Mash bill two is considered a high rye mix, so 12 to 15% rye in there, and that's Blanton's, and Elmer T. Lee also comes from that set. They do have a third mash bill, which is their wheated mash bill, so instead of rye, about 12% wheat, and that is Weller and Pappy Van Winkle, the famous, and I've not done a Pappy, one of these days I will. Pappy's ridiculously famous for no good reason.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because I've ordered it, and it's expensive. It's hard to find, and it's like,
and there's no reason.
What's the big deal?
The same mash bill is in Weller, so just bottle or bottle of Weller.
That's good to know.
I would only say the difference is that Weller's aged in a different warehouse from the Pappy warehouse. The Pappy warehouse is made of stone, and the Weller warehouse is made of wood.
I expected to see God, and all I saw was Paul Theroux.
Listen. I see God every time I drink whiskey. It's a fine thing. Which whiskey doesn't matter at all.
Blanton's is not a bad whiskey.
A lot of that is very good. Like Eagle Rare is very good. Blanton's is very good.
Eagle Rare's special editions are exceptional. They're regular. I got nothing bad to say about any of these. I like an E.H. Taylor. Very drinkable. Right now, Blanton's, because they stick with the single barrel practice. It's not an official term, right? There's no licensing or FDA rules around what it means to be single barrel. So we're just assuming that Blanton still does this.
Sure.
It's one of the reasons it's just like hard to find. Normal retail on a bottle of Blanton's is $65. If you can find one. At the moment, they used to be readily available. It wasn't a big deal. But at the moment, tough to find. But,
well, you tour and get it there.
You can always do that. There's always the funny thing, and I found this with whiskey a lot of times, is travel across the country a bunch. Small towns have it all the time. Big towns don't.
Yeah, nice.
Of all kinds of things. Best chance to find a Pappy, little town of Kentucky.
Sure.
Right? A one bar town in Kentucky will have a bottle of Pappy, almost certainly.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Kids, you're learning more and more every day. And just remember, drink responsibly. Richard Campbell is runasradio.com, and that's where you'll find .net rocks as well, from beautiful Coquitlam, British Columbia, Canada. Thank you, Richard. It's great to see you. Paul Thurrott. He's at Thurrott.com. Become a Prime member. That way you'll get all the good stuff as well as the regular stuff, all the news and all of Paul's great writing. And, of course, his book, The Field Guide to Windows 11, and the new one, Windows Everywhere, both books available at leanpub.com. They're suggesting the title of the show should be I Expected God, I Got Paul Thurrott. I don't know. I don't know. We'll think about it.
I feel like, I mean, it was a good one. But
it's vaguely sacrilegious. I'm not sure.
Yeah, sure.
We do this show, but if you watch live, see, you get to help choose the title. So there is an advantage. We do the show every Wednesday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, 1900 UTC. The live stream is at live.twit.tv. There's audio and video there, and it's running all day and all night. Sometimes reruns, sometimes new shows. So check it out anytime. You can even ask your Amazon Echo or your Google assistant to play. Sometimes it says Twit Live, play Twit Live or Twit Live on TuneIn or YouTube has it. And you can just have it going in the background as you walk around the house. We also have on-demand edited versions with a beginning, a middle, and an end. Well, at least the beginning and the end. I can promise you that. I don't know about the middle. Those are available at the website, twit.tv/ww. You can also get a copy of it on YouTube. There's a dedicated channel, actually, to Windows Weekly. Smash the bell, hit the subscribe, do that. But if you're going to subscribe, really, the best thing to do is do that in a podcast player, because then you'll get it automatically, whether you want the video or the audio, every Wednesday, the minute the show's finished. And that means you don't have to even think about it. You'll just have a nice Windows Weekly for tomorrow. If you are a club member, ad-free versions available at twit.tv/club, $7 a month, but there's a lot more. In fact, my strong suggestion is once you get to be a club member, join the Discord. That's a club benefit. And then go, let me see if I can show you the Discord, and then go to the events, because we've got a bunch of big events coming up. Tomorrow, Fireside Chat with the host of This Week in Space, Rod Pyle. We do Home Theater Geeks now in the club. That's Scott Wilkinson's show. He's brought it back. If you miss Hands-On Photography, you'll love Coffee Time with Mr. Ant Pruitt. That's August 4th, August 26th. Lisa, Ant, and I are going to do a photo walk in downtown Petaluma. If you are in the Bay Area on August 26th, we'd love to see you then for that. You don't have to be a club member for that, but you do for Stacy's Book Club. And a big event coming up in September, a fireside chat with Hugh Howey. We talked to him, the author of the Wolves series, which Apple TV's fire show Silo is based on. And then Daniel Suarez, of course, we all know Daniel, together in a talk. I'll be joining that one, I think. I can't miss that, September 7th. But this is just one of many events going on. Oh, I see Lou Maresca is going to do an AMA as well. We have events going on all the time in the Club Twit Discord. So you get ad-free versions of all the shows. You get all the gifts in the Club Twit Discord. You get special shows we don't do anywhere else, like Paul Thurrott's Hands-On Windows. Maybe we'll do that Clip Champ series in the next series of Hands-On Windows shows. $7 a month. That's nothing for so much extra content. twit.tv/clubtwit. And of course, you also get the heartwarming feeling to know that you are supporting what we do here on Twit. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you,
sir. Have a great week. You're coming home next week, Paul, or you're going to be in Mexico?
Yeah, and I'll be home next week.
All right.
I'll come back in October.
Wow. So the gaps are getting shorter and shorter and shorter.
I'd like good. The trips to get longer and longer.
Yeah,
and longer,
I think so. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It becomes a question of where home is at some point.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And you're going to be moving. You think next week you'll be in the beach house?
No, this time next month.
Next month, okay.
Yeah, the heavy move comes like the 22nd of August. And then from then on, we're camping here, if anything.
This is the beauty of this. Is you can be anywhere in the world, and we could do the show.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter. It's just really a question great. Of where the rig lives. So
yeah.
I'll keep enough rig here for a little while yet. But then we go to Copenhagen for 2 weeks. So we'll get a show. Yes. You'll get a show in Denmark and a show in the Netherlands.
Can't wait.
And I'll be back.
I wish I could be with you.
Yeah,
have a little
bit. Then it'll be oceanside views after that.
Delicious Danish beer. Thank you, everybody. We will see you next time on Windows Weekly. Bye-bye.
Hey, I know you're super busy, so I won't keep you long, but I wanted to tell you about a show here on the TWiT network called Tech News Weekly. You are a busy person, and during your week, you may want to learn about all the tech news that's fit to, well, say, not print, here on TWiT. It's Tech News Weekly. Me, Micah Sargent, my co-host, Jason Howell. We talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news, and we love the opportunity to get to share those stories with you and let the people who wrote them or broke them share them as well. So I hope you check it out every Thursday right here on TWiT.